It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. Thanks to Jason Snell for filling in for me last week. I'm back. And man, we have a great show for you. Amy Webb is here. Christina Warren. We're going to talk about the arrest of Julian Assange. Can you defend him? Maybe you can. We'll also talk about Amazon. They're moving into your house. And baby's first Chinese internet. How Amy keeps her child safe online. It's all coming up next on Twit.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 714, recorded Sunday, April 14th, 2019. Baby's first Chinese internet. This Week in Tech is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring is challenging, but there's one place you can go where hiring is simple and smart. That place is ZipRecruiter, where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. Try it free at ZipRecruiter.com/twit. And by Molecule. Molecule is reimagining the future of clean air, starting with the air purifier. For $75 off your first order, visit Molecule.com and enter the promo code TWIT1. And by ExpressVPN. Protect your online privacy with one click. It's that easy. For 3 extra months free with a 1-year package, go to ExpressVPN.com/TWIT. And by WordPress. Turn your dreams into reality and launch your website at WordPress.com. Get 15% off any new plan at WordPress.com/TWIT. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news. Aloha from Hawaii East. I'm Leo Laporte. Thanks to Jason Snell for filling in for me last week. Back from vacation, as you might have noticed. And we thought we'd have some fun this week with two of my favorite people. Amy Webb is here, our futurist from amyweb.io. She is the founder of the Future Today Institute, professor of strategic foresight at NYU's Stern School, and the author of two wonderful books, The Signals Are Talking, where she explains how you can do her job, and then The Big Nine, where she shows how you can't do her job. Only Amy Webb can do her job. This is the new book and really, really good. Hi, Amy. Welcome.
Hey, Leo. Welcome back.
It's good to have you here. Also joining us, she's been all over the world. Christina Warren, senior cloud developer advocate at Microsoft. She's been on the Ignite tour to Milan and Dubai and all over the place. Hello, Christina.
Hey, Leo. Welcome back.
Thank you. Welcome back to you, too.
Thank you.
All right, you're not done, though.
No, I will be in Stockholm next week, and then I will have a few weeks off, but Build is in between that time, and then I will be in Mumbai at the end of May. And then, knock on wood, I will not be traveling internationally for a little bit. So,
what do you do on these Ignite tours? They're for developers, right?
Yeah, they're for developers and for IT professionals and operations people. And so I actually give two talks at each stop is what I've been doing. So I help out with the opener, which is kind of like what we're doing in lieu of a keynote, where we kind of show off some of the different things that you can do with Visual Studio Code, with Live Share and some of our different CI/CD interfaces. And then I give a talk on introduction to Azure and cloud computing. So it's kind of like a high level 101 course for people who maybe aren't familiar with cloud computing and especially kind of the Azure ecosystem. It goes into things like the differences between containers and VMs, and talks a little bit about what serverless computing is and things like that. And then I do a talk on introduction to Azure networking, which is talking basically about how various networking, virtual networking, a load balancer, and other types of services work on Azure, and how people can use that to connect their on-prem stuff to what might be in the cloud or and all that. So,
well, it's great to have you both on. I followed the tech news the whole time I was in Kauai. I did.
Why
know, because I knew that I was coming back today, and I thought, I don't want to not know what happened. I admit, a little shocked to turn on the TV a couple of days ago and see Julian Assange carted away from the Ecuadorian embassy in London, looking, I'm afraid, a little like...
A little haggard?
Well, I think he was going for the Jesus thing. I don't know what it was. He almost was like blessing people as they took him out. There he is. So, but there are two takes on this. The U.S. government says, oh, no, we're not going after him for what he published. We're going after him because he hacked and encouraged hacking. He helped Chelsea Manning break into a classified system. They have emails saying my team is working on it. That's the smoking gun, apparently. On the other hand, it's pretty obvious that the minute they arrested Chelsea Manning, they were gunning for Julian Assange. WikiLeaks published a stunning video, which I vividly remember, called Collateral Murder, showing U.S. drones used on civilians, or actually it was military helicopters, on civilians and journalists. And this is where WikiLeaks really became famous. More recently, of course, in the election in 2016, Julian went from a hero of the left to enemy of the left when he, we don't know, he published emails from the Democratic National Committee. We don't know if he was acting on Russia's behalf or not. But in any case, that's not what he's been arrested for. He's been arrested for hacking.
The Obama administration, I think...
he was public enemy number one for the Obama administration.
Yeah, it was. But there was, a very salient reason that the Obama administration did not pursue charges against him. And that was because we don't have a clear definition of what constitutes speech in an era of big tech. And so if they were to pursue charges... and if somebody were to claim that he was a publisher doing an act of journalism,
then the First Amendment protects him.
Then, well,
I mean,
it may or may not have protected him, but it opened up an arena for discussion that I think the people who were involved weren't yet ready to have.
Look, Nixon didn't like Daniel Ellsberg because he leaked the Pentagon Papers. But without the Pentagon Papers, we wouldn't have known the true state of the Vietnam War. That was protected. The New York Times and the Washington Post published it. I hope you saw the movie about it, the Post. It was very dramatic. They tried to break into Assange Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office. They wanted him, but they never got him because.
Right. Don't you think this is different though?
My question. Is this different? It's a good article by James Ball in The Atlantic. You don't have to like Julian Assange to defend him. The effort to extradite and prosecute the WikiLeaks founder threatens the free medium, which is in contrast to the Motherboard article we showed earlier, which says it's not about free press. It's about hacking. It's troubling. It's problematic. Assange is a problematic person, but that's the whole point of free speech. You have to defend.
But it raises a really good point, which is we don't have... There are a lot of fundamental questions that unfortunately we are not yet discussing in this country, because our country, in order to have those conversations, requires a lawsuit first, right? To have the conversations where we get to action. So we have a lot of questions around what is speech, what constitutes speech, if it's been automated, are the algorithms to blame, is the data to blame, from that to who owns your face, who owns your biometrics.
And you think the proper place is for the courts to decide?
No, I don't think so. But that, unfortunately, is the way that democracy, democracy, it does in this country. Now, in other countries, they've just jumped ahead to regulation. But this is a problem that's not going to go away.
I should point out that the reason Assange was in the Ecuadorian embassy was not because of U.S. charges, but Swedish charges against him for rape. Those charges were dropped, but now he's arrested for the London Metropolitan Police arrested him on the behalf of the United States. They're going to extradite him because he was indicted in the U.S. for this hacking. At the end of his piece, Ball says Assange might be an a-hole. Scratch that. Assange is an a-hole, but we're going to have to stand up for him anyway. I have very mixed feelings about this. I think he did a lot of good with collateral murder, rather. I think he was probably a Russian cutout in the 2016 election. So there's that. On the other hand, I think...
I mean, there are... I don't know.
But we knew the minute he published collateral murder, he would be... There would be trumped up charges against him of some kind, I thought.
Yeah, so I've had two jobs, two careers. I've been a futurist for 15 years, and the years before that, I was a foreign correspondent. So I worked at the Wall Street Journal and at Newsweek. And here's what I would have to say. You know, there are plenty of cases like the Panama Papers where there's been widespread collaboration and journalists working for the public interest, and much like the Pentagon Papers, releasing information, you know, in a way to shine the light on corruption. I think we need some kind of, you know, Assange makes it sound, and WikiLeaks make it sound like this is all open and through that openness and freedom comes justice, but it's not entirely open. There's still an arbiter, and you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's complicated.
An untrained arbiter who's co-opted by other governments in his own
great.
Ways.
Chelsea Manning, her sentence was, what did Obama do? He commuted it, right? He didn't pardon her. He commuted her sentence.
Right.
He said, you've served enough time. We're going to let you out. Clearly, people were very angry at WikiLeaks for releasing that, but I think it's very analogous to the Panama Papers or the Pentagon Papers. These were government leaks, but they were of information that was in the public interest.
And there's also timing. So while there were certainly revelations about lives that were put in danger, lives that were lost once...
Yeah.
That information was dumped. Yeah. However, there were instances of new people whose lives were put in danger. Again, these are the kinds of things that a journalist or a team of journalists working together would.
No, Snowden did it responsibly, right? Yeah. Snowden took the material and gave it to a number of reputable publications and said, "You need to vet this. And you need to put it out in an appropriate way because I'm not capable of doing that." Assange did the opposite. In fact, I think what you're thinking about that was really troubling was the American diplomatic cables that were leaked that had the names of American agents and put them in grave peril.
That's right. And just because the documents are leaked doesn't mean that they are correct.
They just dumped them out. So, they didn't vet them. They didn't give them to a journalistic entity. They claimed we're a journalistic entity, but they just dumped them.
Right.
Which to me, I guess, is why I've always viewed Snowden and Assange differently.
Yes.
And because of exactly what you said, I've always viewed them in different ways. And my thoughts on Chelsea Manning, although I think that the way that she was treated while she was incarcerated and a lot of those things have been terrible, you know, because she was, you know, a soldier when she leaked that information, you know, there was some, you know, certain things that for me made that a little bit more complicated too. But I think that gets to the key point of this, right? Is that, you know, what he's now being kind of accused of are things that are, you know, I guess fundamentally comes to the question of whether or not what he does is journalism. And although I see
is he making that argument? Is he saying I'm a journalist, I'm doing journalism? I don't think he
has said that. He's not saying that right now. He has said that in the past. WikiLeaks has absolutely said that in the past. But WikiLeaks has changed so much in the last decade that it's hard to know where they stand, right? And I think it's interesting that a lot of the First Amendment advocates and experts have very clearly tried to narrow this and say this is not about, you know, this is not going under journalistic things. And again, this is about hacking, which whether you're a journalist or not is you know, you're not immune to those sorts of things if you're breaking into other people's databases and whatnot. So, but this question does come up, right? Like, is what was the role in this, and how is this different? I'm with you, Leo. It's complicated.
It's troubling to me.
It is troubling in a lot of ways. It's interesting to think about what would have happened if he would have just not been such a jerk,
such a dick
at the embassy.
But that's, you know, okay.
Because it got to the point that it was Ecuador finally had enough and they're like, we're not dealing with you anymore. But
this is a, this is a clear example of short-term gain without thinking about the downstream implications. And I think that in all of my, from what I've read, you know, it seems as though some of the people involved had their hearts in the right places. But again, like, you've got to think in a very rational, measured way. What are all of the implications of making this information public at this particular time in this particular way?
It should have been done, at least should have been done in Snowden fashion. Something more responsibly, well, now, right?
Right. There are, but he's not a U.S. citizen.
Right.
This is the other thing. Like, I know a lot about the First Amendment because I had to study it, you know. A lot of Americans don't quite understand the First Amendment, and people outside the United States aren't bound by it.
Right.
He's
being prosecuted by the U.S., not by people outside of the United States.
Yeah, but it's not, the First Amendment is not a piece of this. This is under a, standard cybercrimes law.
To reiterate your point, this is from the Ball article. The Obama administration had an institutional policy that concluded prosecuting Assange for the publication of classified documents was too controversial and legally risky because a successful prosecution could serve as the foundation for future misuse of that authority to clamp down on more traditional media outlets. The risk to the First Amendment was significant. Mm-hmm. And then he points out perhaps the Trump administration has discovered additional evidence that changes that analysis. And that's what we don't know yet. The optics of it are, if you're going to prosecute him for the email that says, well, our team is working on it, well, we're going to help you crack this, Chelsea. If you're going to prosecute him on that, it's clear that what you're really you're prosecuting him for the release of the information. You just don't want to call it that. It's like putting Al Capone in jail for tax evasion. That's, you know, it wasn't the real reason he was in Alcatraz, but it was an effective surrogate.
Well, and also let's not forget that you never want to, no lawyers or governments want to bring somebody to trial or bring charges if they're not very, very certain that they're going to win.
Right.
And
you know, Assange complicated it by his personality disorder. I guess I could call it a personality. Something went on that caused him to.
I think if you're confined for 7 years,
that could be the reason.
I'm confined.
One of the reasons the Ecuadorian embassy
kicked
him out is he wasn't cleaning up after his cat. That's one of the reasons they gave.
Yeah. Well, there's some other cleaning issues.
He was playing music loud at night. He was stinky, and he wasn't cleaning up after his cat.
There was a great article a few months ago about somebody who, I guess, like, he was their house guest and he wouldn't leave, who described what it was like. And this was years before, you know, he went into the Ecuadorian embassy. Apparently he's like the house guest from hell, no matter where he is and no matter what his circumstances. So, you know,
but you shouldn't put somebody in jail for that.
No, I agree with you, but at the same time, I'm with you, but I also
sort of
sympathize in some ways with the Ecuadorian embassy.
I don't blame the Ecuadorians. In fact, I'm impressed.
You're like, we didn't sign up for this.
For 9 years, they put up with that. It's pretty good.
The sad thing is that this is a good opportunity for us to talk about how to move forward and what needs to change going forward and how to, you know, and that's not happening. We're, you know, like, nobody's taking this as an opportunity to recalibrate how we deal with, you know, our laws and technology and crime and all that stuff.
Your point being that things have changed thanks to technology and we need to update our thinking about what that means, what the First Amendment means in that light.
Yeah, and I feel like this. We cycle every couple years. I'm looking at my bookshelf, and there's a Wired reporter named Andy Greenberg who wrote this really great book called "This Machine Steals Secrets."
Yep.
Like every couple years, there's this conversation that that sort of pipes up, and we all get fascinated about it, and then we forget about it, and we move on, and then we're surprised when it all happens again, or we're stuck in a similar situation where we don't know what to do, and now, you know. I feel like we keep missing these opportunities to make some changes, you know?
And let's not forget, speaking of forgetting, one more person I don't want to forget, who's Reality Winner, who is in jail 5 years for leaking the hacking report that told us that Russia was hacking the elections. And
That one's a stranger case to me.
Yeah. Yeah, that one I feel bad for her in some ways. A, you know, she tried to pass this off the right way. The intercept really messed up there. You know, like, honestly, you look at that and you're like, if you're going to be accepting, if you're going to be, in my opinion, if you're saying, send us secure things and we're going to protect you, then you need to take that of utmost importance. And that they really dropped the ball there in that one.
Under the longest sentence ever imposed in federal court for an unauthorized release of government information to the media. This was more than a slap.
This is interesting, right? So right after WikiLeaks, a handful of news organizations got together, including The Guardian, and created a secure leaking area of their website.
Right.
So, and that had been in use, and the standard, I mean, she, Reality Winner, as far as I understand, followed the appropriate steps to try to port internally and then leak in a way that she would have been covered under whistleblower, I thought.
This is, by the way, why Snowden did what he did. He felt that he would go to jail if he tried that route.
Yeah.
They proved Snowden right, in effect.
Yeah, no, but I mean, and I don't know where the breakdown was of The Intercept with that process. I know that when, because Gizmodo Media Group had Secure Drop, and I know that to even get access, like, I had to do an all-day training thing to even be able to use it. And there were very specific things, and our lawyers were involved, and there was a whole, you know, but there was a whole process. So I don't know where the breakdown was with when they published things or whatnot, like what was visible and what wasn't. But it was something that clearly, you know, was not done correctly.
I feel like she snuck printouts out, and I think that they published those unchanged, and they were able to, because of the secret dots on printouts, they were able to trace it back to her, because they published photos of the printouts rather than the content itself by itself, something like that.
So I'm super curious, the training that you had to look at content that had been leaked, you know, what was the training? Like, what did they teach? What did you learn?
Well, I mean, it was about how to use the system, how to access things, and then there were things about, in terms of like when viewing, you know, data, how to handle it.
Was there like a prescriptive, like, aside from the technical, like how to get the content? Was there like a codified in this, like a decision tree? In this case, tell our legal department. In this case, you can report on the story.
Yeah, I mean, that was definitely part of it. And it wasn't like maybe codified in that way, but it was definitely one of those things. And it was definitely, I mean, for us, it was when in doubt, you know, talk to the lawyers who were fortunately downstairs, you know, to get clearance, and definitely, you know, talk to the lawyers before uploading any sort of documents you get from SecureDrop to Document Cloud or whatever.
Although Gizmodo is probably more concerned about Apple than the U.S. government, right? I mean, it was
not necessarily.
Really? Did you expect leaks from the NSA?
I mean, at this point, some of the best reporters who you have there are Del Cameron so not necessarily. I mean, you never know when you're going to be getting things. And it wasn't just Gizmodo, you know, it was also the investigations team, and it was, you know, lots of other parts of other sites. But no, I mean, you would be surprised.
I'm showing my age and my bias, because I still think of gadget blogs versus real journalism, and that's completely blurred. I mean, I see a headline in BuzzFeed, I think, is this 6 ways to cook a steak, or is this going to be, you know, an expose?
Right.
And often I'm wrong. So, yeah.
I mean, and the truth of the matter is that because we were, a media entity that was known to publish things, people would leak things regardless. You know, people knew that they could come to us because it would get published, which is not always the case. So there were things that we would get that others wouldn't, or that we might be hungrier for, because we would publish those things. And that's still the case with that organization now across all of its different properties, is that they'll publish things that not everyone else will. So you would be surprised the sort of stuff that would come in. And especially around, you know, any of the election stuff, especially around cybercrime stuff. Yeah.
Sure.
You know, there's a lot of that sort of stuff.
Yeah. And there's a big overlap these days between cybercrime and political crime. So absolutely. All right. Well, let's move on. Lots more to talk about. Google's in a little bit of trouble. I'm a little worried about Apple, and Amazon's moving to Bellevue. Are you gonna? I don't know if
they just built the spheres.
I know. They just built them.
They are gorgeous. I mean,
you like the spheres?
I love the spheres.
I'd love to visit them.
73 degrees all year round.
Yeah. Like Hawaii in Seattle.
I mean, it's beautiful. There's like 40,000 species of plant life. It's perfect humidity. It smells good. It's like, I want to move in there. You could work in there.
I know. I live just about, you know, a quarter of a mile away from them, which is why I don't mind them moving to Bellevue, because maybe Seattle West Side home prices will go down. Maybe.
I want to write a dystopian science fiction novel in which Seattle has moved out of the spheres and they've been taken over by gangs. I don't know. There's something there. There's something there. The future. Let's take a break. Our show today brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hello, ZipRecruiter. Good to see you. We're big fans of ZipRecruiter. Hiring is such an important part of building a company. What is a company? A company is made of people with an aligned goal, working together, getting the right people can take your company to the moon and stars. Getting the wrong people can take you down. And that's why hiring is the most important thing you do in your company. It's also sometimes the most challenging. And what's really hard if you're a small company like ours, or you know, you just have a few employees, is you're doing all this when you're down a person. You're already in the penalty box, and now you got to win the game. That's why you need ZipRecruiter on your team. ZipRecruiter is the smart way to hire. First of all, we've already mentioned this. When you go to ZipRecruiter.com/twit and post your job, you're sending it to over 100 of the world's top job boards. So you're spreading your net wide. Your message goes out. You're more likely to reach that perfect person. You just don't know. You know they're out there. You just don't know where they are. So you're more likely to get to that person. But there's more than that. And this is what's so cool. They don't use the word AI, but I almost want to use this word AI, because they use matching technology. See, they already have millions of resumes because lots of people come to ZipRecruiter. It's a job site. So they scan those resumes to find people with the right experience for your job. And then they say, you might want to apply to this job. I've seen this work, because when our bookkeeper 6 months ago gave us 2 weeks notice, Lisa went, oh no, I have to do the books. I don't want to do it. And I got to hire. So this was at breakfast. I said, ZipRecruiter. She posted it before lunch. We had three. They came in, like, kept coming in. Oh, this is good. Oh, this person's great. We had three before lunch great candidates. That's that artificial intelligence. That's that matching technology. As the applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one, spotlights the top candidates, so you never miss a great match. And by the way, they don't flood your inbox. They don't call you. It all goes into the ZipRecruiter interface. All the resumes are formatted so they look the same. It's easy. You can even have screening questions, essay questions, true, false, multiple choice. So you can eliminate people who just don't fit. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. We got one within the first hour. It blew my mind. Right now, This Week in Tech listeners can try ZipRecruiter free at our exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/twit. ZipRecruiter.com/twit. ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire. ZipRecruiter.com/twit. We thank them so much for a service that we have used and loved. So I got a little nervous when I read this in the Apple developer documentation. Microsoft's moving this way too. I'm actually curious, Christina, what you think of this. I think every operating system looks at mobile operating systems, especially iOS, and says, you know, iOS is more secure because Apple requires developers to have, you know, a signature, and they vet the apps. Microsoft released Windows S. Same idea. You got to get it through the store. I know that Apple has Gatekeeper on Mac OS. And now the latest thing, which scared some people, and maybe it depends how you read this. Apple says before 10.14.5, the next version of Mac OS, if you want to distribute software on Mac OS, your software has to be notarized in order to run. In a future version of macOS, notarization will be required by default for all software.
That really confuses me. I heard about this and I read through it because I've got a couple of scripts that I wrote that are going to be broken.
Right.
But I don't understand.
So like, code signing makes sense.
You already had to.
For security. But right now, if you download an app on Mac OS and it's not signed, but
right,
you.
Right, I have to like bypass permissions.
It's more like Android, where Android you could check
you have
a
to
box.
Right-click. Yeah, you have to right-click and say, I agree to install this anyway. Yeah. Yes.
Right. So and it strikes me that this is a way to lock out anybody who has not gotten the additional layer of.
Which is not free, already, by the way. You have to have a developer ID. You have to, you know, there's
so
a lot of.
The extra, like, what is this? Why make the change, I guess, is the thing that I don't quite understand.
Well, there's
not really.
There's also issues if you're, like, you have your own scripts. If you're doing development at home and you write a program for yourself, can you run it? So I've seen a lot of commentary on this. And the question is, what does Apple mean? Apple has yet to explain that when they say notarization will be required by default for all software, does that mean that that's the default, but the end user can override it? Must mean. Otherwise.
Yeah.
You couldn't write your own programs.
Yeah, I believe that's how I'm reading it, is that it's going to be by default the same way that Gatekeeper is by default. It's going to say that apps have to be notarized. And I assume that the reason they're doing this is that what has happened a number of times is that there will be software that is signed by a developer certificate and then is something happens to it. It's you know, bypassed in some way. And so they want to have that one extra level of protection to ensure that that's happening. If you're writing your own scripts and whatnot, and if you do have, you know, a developer ID, there is a way that you can kind of build this into your workflow and have the notarization process part of it. And like, I pay for a developer account in part just to do stuff like that. And also because I like to get the early access builds to things.
It's $99 bucks. It's not prohibitively expensive.
No, but it's also not one of those things that every single person who creates a few custom Apple script things should have to do, you know, if they don't want to get alerted all the time. Like there's kind of a ridiculous process there. It would be nice if they had a way to get notarized without having to be part of the developer program. You know, like if it was something that would be free, that was separate, that's like, okay, if you want to distribute in the App Store, you have to pay. But if you're not distributed in the App Store, we'll still give you a developer account. We can notarize your stuff, but
you can self-notarize. You know, okay.
But you have to
have a developer ID and a certificate.
Right, that's just like a name, like a new name for an existing work stream.
My understanding, the point of this would be that we know who made every app running on your system. You know who?
Do they not currently know that?
No, of course not. I can give you an app. I can send you an app.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah.
Somebody else.
Yeah. Okay, so now you have to be verified by Apple. This is you. This is your real address. And as you point out, Christina, this has not worked perfectly. There were Turkish certificates that were used by malware. They were legitimate certificates.
Yeah. There have been a lot of those. And there's also been the sort of thing what's happened is that people oftentimes for pirated stuff, because we were seeing this on iOS as well, where people would use the enterprise certificates and
that
as a way to distribute.
Including Facebook
apps.
And Google.
Exactly. Precisely, right? And what they were doing was actually something that a lot of, you know, companies have used for years to kind of get away with some of the App Store restrictions, because for the enterprise things, you can bypass a lot of that stuff. So they're like, oh, we want to access pirated content. We can do that using this app that has been done by a developer certificate. And I guess because they have so many of those aren't vetted in the same way. And like you said, the Turkish malware instance, that's been the sort of situation. So I think that they're trying to, you know, stop that as a vector of spreading malware and spreading other things, because people do use their you know, developer certificates to distribute stuff. And there might not be that, you know, same level of scrutiny that you think that there might be. So, but you're not wrong in the fact that it's going to be an edge case, but it's going to be the edge cases where this is one of those instances, at least in my opinion, where the people who are impacted the most by this are some of the power users and the people who are really dedicated to being on Mac OS.
Well, and people who use Microsoft's Visual Studio on Mac, because it says you have to use Xcode 10 or later. The only reason if Microsoft said this, everybody go, yeah, you know, no, that's, you know, there's always going to be a way, but people, maybe it's just me, but
But I'm paranoid about Apple. The day they started the App Store and Gatekeeper, I thought it's only a matter of time before they make sure that everything goes through the App Store. This is their new model. Mm-hmm. We collect 30% of all revenue for the privilege
and
of letting you run something on Mac OS. There is an advantage that they, you know, a case you can make to consumers. Well, it makes you safer. I guess it would be really problematic to do it on a desktop operating system, though.
Yeah.
So what happens I have a couple of, there's a couple of different ways of distributing prototype software, and I'm trying to figure out how does that even
well on work iOS they have that track, they have a way of doing it. They have a test flight application.
Exactly, there's test flight,
and that's test when you use that enterprise certificate,
right? But what part then is notarized? Is the do you have to like go through this entire process?
Yes.
In the initial builds?
I can't just send you something to run on iOS.
Right. But I think that what it'll happen is that it's to be part of that build workflow. So once you build it in Xcode, it's going to be the same way it would be signed now, the way that you would have to still sign some sort of, you know, prototype thing to go through, you know, Hockey or Test Flight or whatever. The notarization process is going to be part of that workflow. And I don't know definitively. I'll have to check for Visual Studio for Mac. But I assume that because there is like a CLI and there are different ways that you can incorporate Xcode stuff into other IDEs like Visual Studio for Mac, that they will just, you know, use that.
That would
sort
make
of
sense,
thing.
Right? You use that part of Xcode to
exactly.
Sign.
And I assume it's going to be a pain when you get set up, but I think that the idea will be once you have it done and once it's in your kind of, you know, keychain of things that you're doing with your tooling, theoretically, it shouldn't be that.
I hope so.
There shouldn't be any difference.
I'm sure I'm overstating this. I just, you could see why people went, whoa.
Well, without a doubt, they haven't done a great job of explaining what this is. Yeah. And it's also, you know, when they say by default, that implies, again, like with Gatekeeper, that there's still going to be a way to install other things. And I'm with you. I think that if your main operating system, like even, you know, S mode is a mode, you know, if you need to install things outside of the store or things that can't be done from the store, you can turn that off. Think that, you know, I don't know how many people, I know I wouldn't be willing to accept an operating system. It's one of the reasons I don't use Chrome OS, that only lets you run certain types of applications. It's just,
you know, where this comes from.
I won't put up with it on a laptop.
I'm nervous because I feel like this so-called post PC era, we're hurtling down this track where everything will be like iOS or Chrome OS. And certainly consumers in many respects should be using Chrome OS and iOS. I tell people all the time, that's a safer alternative if your needs are simple. But as a driver of a truck, in effect, I want to be able to do my own thing, and I want others to be able to. I want open source software to exist. There's just a lot of reasons why some operating systems need to be open. I mean, I guess Linux will always be open, right?
Well, there's also interoperability, right? So, I mean, I guess we kind of been talking about that, but this creates another fissure and more balkanization, which is not
That's
good
right.
because
right.
this isn't just about a singular OS. It ties into cloud services, right? So, cloud services have AI now as a service on the cloud, and it's, you know, there's a longer tail here.
Is it something that we need to do to protect users? Is it the security environment has become so hostile?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. If they weren't forced to, people wouldn't go through on firmware updates. They don't change their passwords. Mm-hmm. They're using legacy code. They're downloading what they think are games to their devices.
So it's your brother-in-law's fault. It's not our fault. It's your brother-in-law's fault. Tell him to knock it off.
I should do that.
knock it off. My dad has been the victim of ransomware twice.
Although, so has Norsk Hydro, the second biggest aluminum producer in the world. Merck, one of the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world. It's not like it's restricted to family
members.
There's
another way to think about this. There's another way to think about this, which is if it's the case that people are very concerned about data and privacy, and it's an election year, and Apple's already fairly far ahead with differential privacy and other kinds of measures, right? Then it kind of, to me, looks like a way to generate strategic advantage and leverage over everybody else. If their products are beloved and they've locked them down such that like nobody else can get inside, and they're the literally gatekeepers of all that data.
Yeah.
Under the guise of privacy.
And that's the funny thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Regulations that
we'll
are being
protect
proposed.
You. You're safe in our walled garden.
That's right. That's exactly right. And that would be probably music to the ears of a lot of legislators who are proposing all kinds of crazy privacy measures right now.
Well, speaking of privacy, New York Times with not one but two articles about a Google technology that's being used by law enforcement. See, Google knows where you are at all times. And apparently, Google is happy to share that information with law enforcement. The thing I'd heard about this being proposed in the past, that I think it was in Upper New York State, a police department asked Google, "Well, we'd like to know everybody who is in the vicinity of these convenience store robberies at these times." And Google fought it. And I thought at the time that was kind of refused by the courts as a fishing expedition, except that now, according to the New York Times, this happens all the time where Google will be asked to provide information. In this case, they started with a murder in a Phoenix suburb. A search warrant required Google to provide information on all the devices near the killing, potentially capturing the whereabouts of anyone in the area.
You know, this isn't just Google. Amazon has also the external cameras and Google's external house cameras.
A lot of communities.
Where police are asking the neighbors to let them connect any. There's a community in Dallas where Houston, where the police have asked neighbors to let them take over their cameras and look at footage whenever.
I've seen enough police procedurals on TV to know that the first thing you do is you go to the convenience store across the street and you ask to see the videos because they have a camera pointing at the crime scene. That doesn't bother me as
Why
much.
Why does this bother you?
Because everybody who was in that vicinity is drawn up in this law enforcement net. And in fact, the case that the New York Times talks about, a suspect was arrested due to this data, because his phone said he was on the scene. And it turned out after he spent a week in jail, it wasn't him. It was his mother's ex-boyfriend who borrowed his car. And so this guy, because of this, and see, this is, to me, the classic fishing expedition, where police, I know police would love to say, well, we'd like to know everybody who was in the area. I thought that was illegal, but maybe I'm right. Isn't that unconstitutional?
No, I'm with you. I mean, I don't know. I'm not a fan of this either. The first thing I thought about when I saw this, I was like, okay, well, now I want to purge all of my Google history, you know, on my phone and whatnot.
On Hacker News, that was the immediate response of everybody on Hacker News was, well, here's how you stop that, by turning off all your Google location information.
But of course, what's frustrating about that is that it's helpful to have.
Yeah, and then your maps don't work.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. And it's not like I'm not anticipating being in a situation where this will matter or I will be implicated in something. But it's not about that. I don't like the idea, as you say, of like, it's one thing if the camera that data is captured, you know, from the convenience store or whatever. I know I'm in a public place. I know my image might be there. And if they can identify me and ask me questions, that's fine.
Maybe that's what's different. Because you're in a public area, but that GPS information, and I know some courts have ruled this, is a more personal thing.
Right. And also, we've seen before where, you know, it can be far beyond just that vicinity. You know, they might be asking, oh, we just want this radius. But if they go a little bit further, you know, I mean, it makes me uneasy. I'm not a fan. And I don't like that it seems like this has become commonplace. And to your point that Google is, because I remember the first time that this came up, they're like, oh, no, we're going to fight this. And I naively assumed, oh, well, they're going to continue to fight this. And now it's like, no, we'll just hand it over. It's like, really? Really?
There are fixes here. So that the easy OS fix is just like build it into the OS on your devices and put an off, like toggle on off button in a visible, easy to understand.
Yeah, but remember Google getting in trouble because it turns out when you did turn it off, it didn't actually turn it off.
Well, some of the other apps wouldn't work. I don't know. Again, like but this is not the first time we've had this conversation. We had this conversation after the San Bernardino shootings. Yeah. What was it now? 3 years ago?
Yeah.
So we're going to keep cycling back to this. And what I would say is, you know, the New York Times is a very large publication, but most of America doesn't read it. So like we're having this conversation, you know, most people aren't reading that story and have absolutely no idea how their data are being collected.
Google actually has a brand name for it. They call it Sensor Vault. And according to the New York Times, Google's Sensor Vault is a boon for law enforcement. This is how it works. There's a database. It's connected to a Google service called Location History. Everybody should go to google.com/dashboard and look at your location use history. You'll see how granular it is. By the way, according to the Times, Location History is not on by default, but as soon as you turn on your phone and you start to use a Google service like Maps, it'll say, can I turn on Location History or Photos? Can I turn on Location? You know, and most people say, yes. Google says we use this to target ads and to measure how effective they are. So, by the way, that means they're watching you go into stores. And then they watch the credit card transaction and they know the credit card was yours. And they even offer this information to people who buy Google ads. It's not just a click. We can also tell you if the person ended up buying your product using their credit card because we're watching where they are. Mm-hmm.
And that's actually old technology that launched a couple of years ago where they,
But the thing that's to me a little scary is, and I, you know, I don't blame law enforcement. It's a tool. And if, as long as Google's willing to give this to you, why not?
Sure.
These are called so-called geofence requests. So they say instead of, and see, this is what I thought was unconstitutional. Instead of saying, where was Leo on the night of Friday, July 17th? They say, well, who was in that area on the night of July 17th? Let's see them all, and we'll talk to each one of them, or we'll investigate some other way each one of them. Google labels the devices with anonymous ID numbers. Detectives look at locations and movement patterns, this is according to the New York Times, to see if any appear relevant to the crime. Once they narrow the field to a few devices, Google then, presto, pulls off the hider and reveals the information like names and email addresses. So anyway, it's something people should be aware of, I guess. You're right. Very few people will be, except people who read the New York Times or listen to this show. But I'm surprised this is.
So that again, that begs the question. This is where we get stuck. You know, we buy the technology and so we feel like we own it. And
there's a
feeling like we own it. I think makes people believe that they have some agency in what's being done. And in fact, we don't own any of the technology. We own the ability to use it for some amount of time, but we don't own it outright. Like when you buy a water bottle, you get to determine, you know, all the things that happen with that water bottle on your own. This is not, and I think we've done a piss poor job of making sure that everyday people understand this.
And, you know, as you're to your point that, you know, this is something that probably, governments should look into and regulations about it. Illinois attempted this. April 10th, the Illinois State Senate passed something called the Keep Internet Devices Safe Act. And in fact, it did pass, but after fierce lobbying from an industry association backed by Amazon and Google, they defanged it a little bit by taking away any punishment. But the idea was that no private entity could turn on or enable a device's microphone unless you agreed. And the bill requires any recordings or other personal information captured by devices protect against, quote, unauthorized access, acquisition, destruction, use, modification, and disclosure of the data. Initially, the bill would have made this an unlawful practice under the Consumer Fraud and Deceptive Business Practices Act, which could result in fines of up to $50,000 per case. But lobbying by the Internet Association defanged it by saying, well, we don't have to have a punishment.
Ultimately, Illinois has actually been pretty far ahead in fighting big tech.
This is interesting.
But here's the thing. The laws and the regulation only matters if they are enforced,
right,
and also if they deter people from using things that the regulators think are bad for them. I mean, the problem is that people keep buying and using the stuff knowing that there may be negative outcomes. So, like,
But I'm going to give you, the my reaction to this, which is kind of the opposite, which is, oh, great. Now all these privacy nervous Nellies are going to make it illegal for my Amazon Echo to work.
Right.
And yeah, I want my Echo.
Well, that's the thing, right? That's always the convenience
store. I want it to listen to me.
The convenience store. So if somebody was robbed in a convenience store in the 80s, the police are still going to show up and they're going to ask a bunch of people who were there, and then they're going to round up the usual suspects in probably a very, very racist way, right? I would argue that that's not the only difference between the 1980s and the late 2010s is that it requires less humans and more of that process is automated. But it strikes me that it's sort of like the same process still. Yeah. No?
I don't know. You're right. I mean, now we have racist face recognition, so that's simple.
Right, but it's
that's,
just like the
that
same,
speeds up the process.
It speeds up, right? So it like speeds up what we were kind of already doing. I'm not saying that's good or bad.
No,
I'm
it's just another tool for law enforcement. You said it. There's got to be checks and balances. Law enforcement, I understand, and we want them to fight crime and arrest bad guys, and we want them to do it in a constitutionally protect manner that protects us against overreaching state authorities. So we want both, and we need both. I think I'm not against law enforcement using the technology. I just think it needs to be done conforming with the Constitution and particularly the rules against unlawful search and seizure and testifying against yourself, the Fourth and Fifth Amendments.
Who had that story recently about the people who do QA on, I think it was Amazon devices and like what they've been listening to as part of that QA process?
Oh, yeah. That just came out this week, too.
Yeah.
Amazon said, well, but you know what? This is not a surprise to anybody who understands how AI works.
Right.
That this is called training.
Yeah.
So Amazon says humans are going to transcribe to improve the customer experience some of your recordings. This comes from a Bloomberg story, so we'll give Bloomberg the credit. Amazon workers are listening to what you tell Echo. A global
not
team.
Not everybody.
No.
It's not everybody. They're doing it in
sampling.
Small batches, but
yeah, because they can't.
Right.
They can't.
And I think some of them were in Romania, and some of them, but you know, it sounded like they had questions, like some people thought they overheard domestic violence, other ones heard really.
So
they were PTSD. They had PTSD.
Amazon, according to Bloomberg, employs thousands of people around the world to help improve Amazon's digital assistant. The team listens to voice recordings captured in Echo owners' homes and offices. The recordings are transcribed, annotated, and fed back into the software to make it better, right? To eliminate gaps in Echo's understanding of human speech. And actually, Amazon's asked us to do that too, right? If you can actually go back and look at all the things you said, you can hear what you said, and you can tell Echo if you got it right. The voice review process, and Bloomberg had 7 people, anonymous sources. It's not a surprise. Mix of contractors, full-time Amazon employees who work from Boston to Costa Rica to India to Romania. They can't speak publicly about the program because they sign non-disclosure agreements. They work 9 hours a day. What a nightmare job. Parsing as many as 1,000 audio clips per shift, according to 2 workers.
It sounds about as bad as working as a
Facebook
stacker in the Amazon
that
warehouse.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Look, it's clear that technology has created a lot of inhuman jobs, but at least they're jobs that humans can do.
One of the saddest things I've ever heard. That really got me.
At least we got a job, man, you know?
That's so depressing, but you're right.
But it's true. Until we train them well enough, and then we'll be out of work.
Yeah.
It's like Uber drivers, basically. You're just a stand-in for the artificial intelligence until we get that good enough.
Yeah.
The work is mostly mundane. One worker in Boston said he mined accumulated voice data. You'll like this, film girl, for specific utterances such as Taylor Swift. Apparently they were listening. They were listening to your Echo, and annotated them to indicate the searcher meant the musical artist, as opposed to Taylor Swift, who wrote Gulliver's Travels. What I don't know.
Right.
What other? Occasionally, now
On the other hand, well, I will say, occasionally the listeners picked up things Echo owners likely would rather stay private. A woman singing badly off key in the shower. Well, who doesn't do that? Or a child screaming for help. Ooh, that would be hard. The teams use internal chat rooms to share files when they need help parsing a muddled word or come across an amusing recording. So, Amazon's response, we take the security and privacy of our customers' personal information seriously. We only annotate an extremely small sample of Echo voice recordings. I'm sorry I said the A word. In order to improve the customer experience, for example, this information helps us train our speech recognition and natural language understanding systems. This was exactly the same thing that we were learning about. Who was that that was doing that? Nest? I can't remember.
Oh, with the microphone?
Yeah. This is just what, this is how, I think people, technology is always assumed to be.
It's do it first and apologize later.
Well, but also, it's also assumed there's no human intervention. It's in the shiny box. But somebody's got to train this stuff. We use multi-factor authentication to restrict access, service encryption, and audits of our control environment to protect it. And by the way, this article does not imply that there were leaks of any of this information. It's just a revelation that it happens. But if you'd asked me before this, I would have, and I thought about it, I would have said, well, yeah, I'm sure they're doing that.
And so what happens if somebody decides to do a audio file dump onto WikiLeaks using all of this or whatever?
I mean,
they
can have me singing off key.
And you know, supposedly it's anonymized and there's, but you can still associate the account number according to the story,
this validates all the people say, I will never have an Amazon Echo or Google Home or any of these things in my house.
Yes, they will.
Yeah. I was going to say, I mean, like, so there are some people who won't, but once you've had the ability to say, hey, you know, keyword play, whatever, or read me the weather, or, you know, what's on my calendar, it's kind of awesome. Like, you know, I mean, like, as creepy as all of this stuff has the potential to be, there's this other side of it that is really compelling.
Well, and but it's also like really hard to buy a device that doesn't have a camera or a speaker in it. Like your televisions have a camera. The remote controls you get from your cable services have a microphone built in, and some of them you just talk to, and some of them you have to.
Why do you think that is? Is that because everybody's demanding the ability to ask to watch Game of Thrones?
Because they want the information to sell to other people. The cable companies want to be able to do that. Well, I mean, the thing is that with the TV capture stuff, they don't even need to have the camera and the TV thing. Like, it'll literally capture what pixels are on the screen and then send them out to say, oh, this is what you were watching. I mean, that was what happened with the Vizio and the Samsung cases. It's not even about a camera. It's literally taking a sampling of the pixels that are on the screen. And I tried to do this recently to try to find like a non-smart television set, because I was just looking for like a dumb
I want
TV
a monitor.
Thing.
I'm with you. I just want a monitor. I'll add the intelligence.
You can't do it.
Nope. Can't.
And you can't do it. Like, it's not possible unless you're getting something that's years old out of warranty and, you know, all kinds of other things. Like, they literally don't exist. Even at the very high end where you used to be able to go, and if you spent like X thousands of dollars, you know, it wouldn't have it. Even those, it's like, no, it's going to have the stuff in it.
You know, my rule of thumb for knowing if this is problematic is if my reaction is, well, I have nothing to hide. I'm not doing anything wrong. So if Google knows where I am, big deal. I'm not saying anything bad. So if Amazon's listening to me, big deal. And I know as soon as I say that to myself, which I have, that we got a problem. There's a big problem. Nobody should ever have to say, well, I've got nothing to hide.
No, never.
Did I ever tell you about the origin of the word privacy in Japanese? It sounds like a non sequitur, but it sequits. So I lived in Japan the first time in the 90s, and this was right on the cusp of the internet, and being able in e-commerce and being able to share internet data and buy stuff. And I remember in Japan that I couldn't just order stuff online yet, because it was a very private country, and people thought it was crazy that you would just type in a credit card number. That was insane. This bastion of all this super high tech, you know, was a place where internet e-commerce hadn't hadn't quite landed yet. And when it finally did, they had to invent a word to talk about privacy because wow. privacy was eroding, and they had never had to discuss it before because it was just assumed that that you had it. And the Japanese word for privacy is puraibashi. They borrowed it.
Wow. Isn't that funny that it's not because they didn't know about privacy? It's because it was just you didn't need a word for it. It just is.
Right. So to what you were just saying, which is I don't have anything to hide. I don't like the fact that I have to have that conversation. Yeah. We didn't used to have that conversation. And now here we are where either we just assume that we hope that we don't have anything to hide and yet we have no control over it anyway. So this is just the way we're appeasing ourselves, I guess. Or we try to rail against it or we just close our eyes and forget that it's that everybody else is looking in. I mean,
this is a good, a good panel for this topic because I think well, I'm going to leave myself out. Both of you embrace the future. I'll include myself in that. We're technologists. We love what technology has done and can do for the future. But at the same time, especially you, Amy, as a futurist, we have to grapple with some very difficult challenges that technology brings us.
Yeah.
And I think you're both very well aware of both sides of that double-edged sword.
So, Christina, you have devices listen in your place of residence, right?
Yeah, I do. And I have conflicted things about it, right? Like, I mean, you know, we have them plugged in, but then, I think about that. I'm like, is this good enough? Is this something that I really want? And then
you're more like me because you've lived in public for a long time.
This is true. This is very true.
Yeah.
If you ever feel like you need to have a conversation, have you ever like unplugged your device to have like a private conversation?
I haven't.
Lisa Although won't let me have a idea. Device with a camera in the bedroom.
Mm. Yeah, I don't do that. I don't have and I don't have it in the bedroom.
We have so many listening devices in the bedroom that if I say the A word,
one of the words,
several of them will. I'll hear right. bloop, 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 bloop. By the way, it's a problem in France because the words for with her are Avexa. Apparently, that's a problem. And in Mexico, it's a problem because the word for make, hecho, is also, apparently that's Amazon's reason for having this facility in Romania is the darn French and Mexicans keep saying the word by accident. Mine wakes up all the time for no apparent reason. And so does my Google.
Yeah.
Yeah. For no, Cortana never wakes up though, oddly.
What do you have Cortana on? They don't have a speaker out.
Harman Kardon makes a Cortana speaker, and I have it.
Yeah, I don't even have that.
I have a stack in my office. I have a Google Home Max, which is the biggest. On top of that, the Echo Show, and then on top of
You've got a little rack.
It's not even a rack. They're just standing on top of each other.
It's some kind of like crazy boombox I want to see. Glue it all together. Yeah. Put a little handle on it.
If I had a social network, I would post a picture of it, but I don't.
I have a few Echo devices. I have a bunch of Sonos things that now have the Echo things built in. I do have a HomePod, but I mean, who cares about HomePod Siri?
Siri's terrible. Listening because she does wake up sometimes, right?
Oh, I know she does wake up sometimes.
I'll hear her babbling. She's in our kitchen, and I'll go in the kitchen. She's just babbling. Like she's lost her mind. Like she's talking about something.
I will say I do love Siri on my Apple TV, but that's about the only Siri that I like. And then I got a Google Home Mini from Spotify because they had like some, if you're in a family account, we'll send you a free one. Right. But I'll be honest, I haven't hooked that one up.
Why not?
I don't know. I should. I should put it in one of the places. I don't know.
I feel like I'm podcasting all the time, no matter what. Somebody's
listening. But I think to your point, the whole having to have sort of lived in public thing, that might be part of the difference. There's still lines that I will draw. Like you said, I don't have cameras, in my bedroom or any of those places. But
well, that was my wife. I would have done it. I don't care. I do have an Echo Spot in my closet.
And what about smart mirrors? Do either of you have any of that?
But I'm kind of into it.
Yeah.
Home automation is one of the big trends that we're tracking this year. And so there's a suite of Peloton-like smart home mirrors.
Yeah, I know the guy, Ryan Vance, who was a longtime tech TV guy and did the Tony Gonzalez Fit program, is working with them. I can't wait to get one. Are they out yet?
The one is out. There's another, the really cool looking one that I have a feeling I would rip right off of. I don't know how it doesn't
because
it has
stuff attached to it, right?
Right, right, right. Mm-hmm. But this is kind of the point, right? I think we are trading cool and convenience for a willing and willful ignorance about what happens on the back end. And I think we're all doing it. I mean, if the three of us are doing it and we're hyper connected and we understand, think of the implications for people who are moving into Amazon homes. Amazon and Lennar is America's largest home builder. They've partnered and are building smart homes that don't just have a few Alexa devices, but have...
Imagine your...
Oh, I'm sorry. Things. I started playing this is the tonal device.
You know, the
device.
Smart lock thing, actually, a friend of mine successfully led her apartment complex, and they're a big, you know, kind of chain of building, I guess, management, to not install the smart locks. As she's a security professional, and she was very adamant.
Right?
She is right. Because, and look, to me, that is one of those places where I would completely not be okay with that, I'm being told you have to have this smart lock installed. You don't have any alternative. This is what we're going to do. We can enter your, you know, house at any time, especially when the security behind those has been so easily hacked and whatnot.
Like, I don't like that. I mean, aren't locks just a suggestion anyway?
Sure.
I mean, it's just a social norm. It's not really...
And there's windows. If somebody wants to break in, wants to get into your house.
If somebody doesn't mind breaking the social norm, they can get into your house.
I mean, this is where it's useful to look at the bigger constellation of things. So Amazon has also invested in prefab home companies. You know,
they have a whole system, right? The whole house is smart.
That's right. So that's what I'm saying. We're quibbling right now over smart, whether or not we have a camera in our bedroom. And I guess what I'm trying to say is, unless we change how we think about this, it's inevitable that we will all have camera, that we'll all constantly be under persistent surveillance, which in some ways I think are great, but we don't have all of the back end legal infrastructure and privacy infrastructure, all that other stuff in place yet. The technology, as usual, is pushing far ahead of our capacity to think about what it all means.
Right. I mean, but the one thing I would say that kind of gives me hope a little bit with this, because of course you're completely right, but there does seem to be kind of a breaking point where people are pushed too far. And I mean, Facebook is going through that right now, where for many, many years, many of us never expected that the public would ever turn against Facebook, despite all the different things that they were doing and all the different, you know, breaches that were happening. And then with the combination of Cambridge Analytica and the, you know, involvement with Myanmar and the ridiculous, amount of other atrocities, you know, less people are using them. They have actually seen fewer people signing into, you know, standard Facebook. Now they still have their myriad of other services that they can get all kinds of information from, but there is this palpable kind of backlash against that. And so, you know, it's about finding that balance. But I think to your point, yeah, when even those of us who know better are still willing to take, you know, the bad parts, even knowing what can potentially be bad about being in this, you know, always on surveilled society, like what chances anyone else have? I mean, I even think about myself. So I travel a lot. And before the show, you both travel a lot as well. You know, with biometrics and whatnot, with, you know, the amounts of times I go through airports, you know, I use Clear. I'm in these other things, like my photo, my fingerprints, other information about me is maintained and in an uncountable number of databases, you know, my passport information, my photos, all that stuff as I travel through airports, and it's now being held by foreign governments. And that's not even something that I have the opportunity to opt out of, right? Like that's just, if you want to fly through someplace, that's what you have to do.
Aren't you just tempted to give up at some point? I mean, have you given up or
yeah.
No?
I mean, I have and I haven't. It's like I'll have certain things that I will. But yeah, there's a certain amount of malaise, I think, and fatigue with all of it.
Fighting it is so hard. And ultimately, you have to move to a cabin in the woods.
Or you try to create systemic change, which is
that's what you do. And I like that.
To me, giving up is tantamount to giving up on our futures.
The big nine.
I'm not willing to do that.
Amy's book is all about that.
Well, because we can, I don't want to like the, if you like stop for a moment and just think about what's the worst possible feeling you could have. For me, it's regret. Like that is the worst. And I don't want to be 30 years from now looking like feeling a horrific sense of regret that we could have taken a different path and we could have chosen to slow down for 5 seconds and figure out how can everybody still make plenty of money. You know, but how can we make this so that everybody wins and doesn't, you know, everybody wins a little more and loses a little less. I don't want to be filled with regret that I didn't play my part. I didn't do something when I could have. Like that's the worst, that regret, that's like the worst feeling, because where it comes from is a place of there was something that I could have done differently, or I didn't have to make that mistake, you know, and I could have had a better outcome. I don't want to be in that place. So that's why I refuse to give up.
I've even given up on regret. I just know I'm going to regret this. That's just life. Regrets I've had a few.
You haven't. That's why we're talking about this stuff. We could have spent the whole time talking about Apple.
You know, I think there's a good chance
LED screens
that we'll end up in the world of Idiocracy, where I think we're assuming that all this stuff is going to work and that we're going to make a perfect surveillance system and it's going to know everything about us. There's also the option. Here's the smart home that Lennar is building with Amazon. This is the pantry. It's lined with something that no longer exists, dash buttons. They thought, this will be great. In the pantry, we'll put dash buttons next to everything, and then you press the button when you run out, except Amazon stopped making them.
Yeah, right, but
I feel like we're creating technology, a janky future that's just going to break down.
That's, again, look at the bigger picture. There's sensor technology being built inside of materials that are in our pantries. So you don't need a dash button as long as you put your stuff back in the same
technology that we, it's like Las Vegas hotel where as soon as you take it off the shelf,
the mini bar
paying for it. Yeah.
I had a bunch of dash buttons and I loved the idea of them in theory. And I did actually hack them so that they could be used for other things, which was really fun. The problem was, so you get them for toilet paper. That's a perfect thing to get them for, except you don't think about the fact that you need toilet paper until you're on your last
just
bowl, or it's
stay
over
there
with.
For and a it, day or two and it will be delivered.
Well, and that's the issue, right? At that point you're like, okay, I'm gonna actually have to run down the street and buy toilet paper rather than waiting for Prime to come. Now if they had integrated the dash buttons with Prime Now, like the same day delivery thing, where
that's right,
right, where like, because I use Prime Now all the time and way too much. And at that point I'm like, oh, I can get this in an hour if I pay another $5, done. Like that would be useful, but it wasn't. So, you know, I did enjoy my Haribo one though, because I had one for the gummy bears.
That's dangerous.
Can I offer a totally unrelated tangent? That's funny, but related to gummy bears.
Always.
Okay. So where I grew up, I grew up in Northwest Indiana, just outside of Chicago. And there's this gummy bear factory called Albany's, and they make both regular gummy bears and sugar-free gummy bears.
Oh, do not do the sugar-free gummy bears.
Oh, my, the sugar-free ones are so bad. Oh, no.
If you want to have a really good laugh, go on to Amazon and look at the reviews for the sugar-free gummy bears. It's like,
oh, my God.
It's like it'll be like the best 10 minutes you've spent ever.
Let's, for those who are wondering what could possibly go wrong.
And it's totally true.
The fake sweetener they use has a slightly laxative effect. You can imagine the rest.
Yeah.
Well, if you only eat one, you're okay.
If you eat like 3 to 4 of those,
it's explosive.
And, you know.
It's very explosive. We had somebody who actually
sell them in 5-pound bags.
It's the best Amazon review ever.
Oh, yeah. No, that's what I'm saying, because I buy the 5-pound regular bags all the time, and you have to make sure you don't get the sugar-free ones, because, yes, there was actually, we had somebody, I think it was a Gizmodo, who like knowingly did a review of them and thinking, oh, it can't be that bad. And then it was worse than anyone could have ever imagined.
So the top positive review on Haribo sugar-free classic gummy bear 1-pound bag is the horror at 30,000 feet. The top critical review is one of the worst days of my life.
Wait, but that's the Haribo. You need the Albany's.
Albany's is worse?
No. Yeah, that's where the hilarious ones. A-L-B-A-N-E-S-E.
You seem fairly hilarious. Okay, Albany's.
Yeah.
So this is the hometown favorite.
It is.
The results are noxious and disgusting. Use at your own risk and be prepared for a fate worse than death.
So all those 561 critical reviews are hilarious, detailed accounts about...
Partly because they sell them in 5-pound bags.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a really funny one that's like, why would you sell this in a 5-pound bag?
The Night of 1,000 Waterfalls.
That's a good one.
Like distant thunder. Just don't, unless it's a gift for someone you hate. These are good for losing 10 pounds. All right, so we won't buy these. I didn't realize that there was an alternative to Haribo.
When you need them.
Well, the funny thing is, even though they're sugar-free, they have exactly the same caloric count as non-sugar-free, so... What are they using for the sweetener?
Who even knows? But it's something bad.
Something you don't want to eat.
Regular ones are good. They're flavorful.
They're flavorful. They're delicious. It's in the heart of everything we do. It's not just on our bag. It's at the heart of everything we do.
They're like a family-run company.
I feel so bad.
That's been there
for
forever.
Them.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're using erythritol or some sort of sugar alcohol, I'm sure. Oh, maltitol. That is actually literally baby laxative.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
That's good. It's the number one ingredient.
That's so messed up.
Yum. All right. Let's take a little tiny break. Amy Webb is here. I'm looking for your big book. I want to get this. Now, you sent it to me, but people can get it themselves, right, from the Future Today Institute?
Tech Talk Report?
Yes.
This is available for free online. We give away all of our research. We always print up some for our clients. And so I've got, like, we have a handful. If you want to buy a hard copy, you can go to our website, but you can download it for free. It's
so,
huge.
Yeah, you can make your own printout if you want.
Yeah. I mean, it's a ream of paper, but yeah.
Future Today Institute. But Amy is, I'm even more excited about this than the 5-pound bag of gummy bears you said you're going to send me. She said she's sending me one. I can't wait. And also, Film Girl, it suddenly got dark in.
It suddenly got dark. So during the break, I'm going to turn on the lights in the building go off at a certain period of time. So during the break, I'm going to switch them back on again. Yeah, they're trying to, like, you know, save the environment or something, save money. But I will go reset that in just a second.
That's good. I'm taking a break. Here's something you would love, by the way, in your team space. How many people are in that team space?
It varies. I mean, I think we've got like 6 desks, but
okay, you need a molecule air freshener for sure in there.
Yeah.
We have this in our house. It's funny because Lisa, we were in Hawaii. I don't know why. No pollen, no runny nose, no headache. The minute she gets home, pollen in the air. Our cats come in. They're yellow. They're black cats, but they're coated with yellow pollen. You can see around the food bowl all this yellow pollen. It's that time of year, and we've had a big rainy season, so it's an allergy nightmare. Thank God we have the molecule. This saved our lives. We've had the molecule now for a couple of years, and it's fun because if somebody turns it off or we go away, Lisa knows immediately. But when that's running, it is a miracle. Molecule is not, it's not a HEPA filter. It's reimagining the future of clear air. It uses something they call PICO technology. The HEPA filter has been around since World War II. It's a filter, literally, and it can trap big particles, but not the little ones that can cause some of the worst allergies and other problems, health problems. The PICO technology, short for photoelectrochemical oxidation, goes well beyond what a HEPA filter will do. It not only captures allergens, okay, HEPA filter might do that, but it eliminates them. Mold, bacteria, viruses, particles so small they go right through a HEPA filter, trapped and eliminated. Even airborne chemicals, volatile organic compounds, like formaldehyde from your carpet or fumes from paint. Pollutants 1,000 times smaller than those a HEPA filter can catch. Molecules technology has been personally effective and verified by science and used by real people like us, including allergy and asthma sufferers around the country. We have my son has a friend who has asthma,
comes with his breather, his inhaler. He never needs to use it when he's in our house. We like it so much, we got one for Michael's bedroom. We now have one in the studio, too. It's amazing. The technology was funded by the EPA. It has been tested by third parties and university laboratories like the University of South Florida's Center for Biological Defense, Minnesota University's Particle Calibration Laboratory. Really beautiful. It's a solid, sleek aluminum. It's kind of like the Apple of air purifiers. Very easy to change the filters. It has two filters, a pre-filter and then that Pico filter, which is it's almost like a catalytic converter. It captures the particles and then UV light burns the particles up. It's really kind of remarkable. Plus, you can tie it to your Wi-Fi network or a Bluetooth network, control it via Bluetooth. It has controls on the top, but if you want to do it with your phone. And the nice thing about tying it to your Wi-Fi, it'll automatically order new filters when you need them, auto refills. Molecule's amazing. We're going to get you $75 off your first order. And if you've heard these ads before and went and saw that they were sold out, they now have them in stock. They do sell out fast, though. So go to Molecule with a K, MOLEKULE.com, and use the promo code TWIT1. It's a new promo code, TWIT1, at checkout for $75 off your first order. Don't just capture allergens. Destroy them with Molecule. You'll thank me later. Molecule.com, promo code TWIT, and the number one, MOLEKULE. And we thank them for their support. Here's the, this is the gym on the wall that you were talking about, Amy. It's called the tunnel.
Yeah.
So this is a smart mirror. I don't know if this is what I want, but I thought a smart mirror would just say, hey, you look good today. Or
there's another one. There are a couple out there where this looks like it's just showing. The ones that I've seen, and I can't remember the brand.
This has stuff on them.
Looks though. At what you're doing, and then automatically changes the tension and tells you to move your posture.
Xbox used to do that.
I like that.
With the Kinect.
Yes, they did.
Right?
Yep.
It would know your heart rate. It would know if you're working hard enough. It would adjust it based on that. That really killed me when they killed that product. I thought that was a great product.
It was great. It had good stuff, for sure.
Just shows you sometimes.
But people freaked out. Like
is that
when
why?
Xbox One came out, people freaked out about the Kinect stuff and the always on stuff. Like and a lot of the things, people were like not into it. So yeah.
So Apple bought the company, was an Israeli company, and it's in the front of your iPhone 10 and 10S.
I know, and it's funny because Windows Hello has a lot of that same stuff with it too, and it's great. I'm always amazed by how
Was it just only ever a subsidiary?
They didn't buy Kinect. They bought the company that did the foundational technology for Kinect.
Oh, okay. Right.
Apple stole them out.
The company that made the camera, the three-dimensional kind of IR camera sort of tech for the very first Kinect. The second Kinect, the Kinect for the Xbox One was made, I think, in-house.
PrimeSense was the sensor
Prime
company.
PrimeSense, yes.
PrimeSense. Mm-hmm. And Apple bought them, which is kind of weird that Microsoft knew.
I think it was done in-house because the second Kinect was made by a different, was made with different stuff. And Windows Hello is largely the same idea. And
once you get the idea, it's not probably too hard to.
Yeah. Windows Hello always impresses me, but it can be like at a weird angle. And it'll still, as long as I'm not out in bright sunlight, it'll recognize me basically anywhere. I wish I had Face ID on my laptop. I mean, Touch ID is fine, but there is something about just having to like casually glance up and automatically be logged in that's very nice.
So I got a new Windows laptop. I got that new ThinkPad, and I have the choice between all the different because it has a Hello camera. It has a Hello fingerprint reader. I could also there's like eight ways to log in, and I'm using the fingerprint. But you know what? I think Hello as secure. The face recognition as secure as a fingerprint. Is it good?
Yeah, it's the exact same. I mean, it's the exact same encryption. So whether you're using the fingerprint sensor or the camera,
but I mean, somebody can't. My twin can't unlock it, right? Actually, I don't have a twin, so that probably is true.
Yeah, I mean, I think your twin probably could unlock it.
That was a problem with Apple's iPhone X, right? The family members were able to unlock it.
Well, I mean, I think it's a problem with anything. If you have an identical twin, they're probably going to be able to use their facial thing to do it, probably, honestly. If you have like an identical twin, it's not enough to be you look alike. Like even fraternals, it might not work. But if you have an identical twin, I mean,
there
you
was
also have the same DNA. So, you know,
right. When the iPhone 10 came out, there were a mother and son. And he could unlock his. In fact, wait a minute. Megan Maroney's son could unlock her iPhone 10, come to think of it.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And they're identical twins, so they could unlock each other and they could unlock her. So it's, I think, as I remember, it does things like spacing between the eyes. It does the geometry right. of the face. It's doing, you know, all these weird things.
And then it's changing things every time you're right. using it, updating. So, you know, the fingerprint sensor is obviously really fast too, because one of my laptops, my Huawei doesn't have Face ID or doesn't have the Windows Hello.
Oh, but it
camera.
Has a better fingerprint reader though, I think.
Yeah, but it has it does have the Windows Hello fingerprint reader.
Right.
So that's
very good.
Instantly,
yeah.
like it's super fast. On my Surface Book, obviously that has Windows Hello, and it's interesting how even if it's your hair changes or makeup or you know, weight or whatever, like it continues to just be able to pick it up and work.
It does. I know why. See, the problem, this is a desktop, the Surface Studio, and every time I want to log in, I either have to lean over it like lurch or raise it up so that it can see me, because it has to be at the right angle. So there is a disadvantage to having it
there
on
is.
A desktop.
Yeah, I was going to say, I have the same issue with my iPad Pro, because if I'm like laying in bed with it
right.
and I've got it at a weird thing, then I have to like sit up. Hold exactly. up. I've got right. the same sort of situation.
Yeah.
So you know that Walmart has a smart shopping cart. Did I talk to you about this last
no.
time I was on? So,
oh, that's interesting.
How smart is it?
So real smart. So it's not in production yet, but they've built a concept for a shopping cart that collects basic biometrics once you get to the store. So you would lay your hands on the shopping cart and it takes
put your hands on the shopping cart.
It takes a baseline reading of your heartbeat, your perspiration, the tension
what?
That you're holding the cart with.
Why?
And obviously, there are also cameras all around the store. And I think the idea is as you move throughout the store, it looks for fluctuations. So if you get to aisle 7 and you're trying to find your Captain Crunch and you're ready to, you know, you can't find it and you're ready to blow a gasket.
My heart always pounds when I get to the Captain Crunch aisle.
There is a
that is really smart.
Holy
you know, who comes over to help you find it, but obviously there's data being
now mined. Are they pitching this to say, oh, and it could save your life if you have a heart attack at our store or no?
You know, I don't know what their pitch. I don't think so at the moment, but here's the, I mean, you guys are giving away your faces and your fingerprints and
everything. Mm-hmm.
We don't you know, what happens if one of these companies gets bought or sold, right? I mean, because we're
true.
Sort of black, we're kind of like lackadaisical about all of our biometrics as well as our DNA.
That's why I haven't done any of those DNA kits, frankly, even though I would really like the information from them and I think it would be really good. I haven't done it. That's kind of where I draw the line. My fingerprint stuff, I don't really have a say in the matter in some of the cases, you know, especially if you're, you know, like I said, if you're traveling a lot or whatever, but for some of the, and my face, I certainly don't, but my DNA is the
no,
one thing
I mean,
thing
our
where
faces
like,
are like, they're in, like, right. But like some of this other, I mean,
well,
I don't
did
know.
You, did you read in today's New York Times, the Privacy Project, Sarah Jong, writing about, at first I thought, you know, the title is AI is changing insurance. Some technologies are better left in the laboratory. At first I thought, I'd like to know what is insurance. This is more a potential threat.
Mm-hmm.
But this is something, if I'm Dvorak, you know, whenever we talk about privacy, this is always the example he would use. Well, you know, you go buy donuts a lot. If the GPS says you're always at the Dunkin' store, you're
right.
gonna have a hard time getting insurance. But maybe this is what insurance companies are planning to do.
Oh, completely it is. I mean, that's always been, I mean, they'll give you the subsidized Apple Watch or Fitbit or Fitbit knockoff, which is,
yeah, they have what, that's real. They offer, if you use a
right.
Fitbit, you can get a reduction in life insurance, right?
Right. Because my parents, for instance, like, I guess, whatever their thing is, like, my dad had, like, a knockoff Fitbit, and it broke, and he didn't like it. So for his birthday, which was, like, a week and a half ago, I bought him whatever the latest, greatest Fitbit was. I was like, here you go.
Because John Hancock did this last year, I remember.
Yeah. But, you know, and that's a good thing. You can get reduced, you know, rates and whatnot. But then you do wonder, okay, at least for now, how it's worked is that they'll just give you kind of, you know, like a, you know, some you know, like a lower premium or whatever, regardless of what your health is. But then you wonder, okay, are they going to start trying to gather the information from that? And at least right now, they're not. But that's got to be the next level, right? Which is they're saying, oh, you know, if we're seeing this sort of activity, then we can anticipate that you can have lower premiums. But the inverse is true too. If we see, you know, this type of activity, then we will charge you more. That I'm not super jazzed about. And I say this as somebody who, by, you know, all accounts would be on the lower premium scale, at least for things like, you know, like heart disease and cholesterol and blood pressure and whatnot.
I'm waving at you from the other end of that scale. Hello.
Right.
Well,
I have a
picture this. This. You're wearing devices. You're effectively plugging into Apple and or Apple and Google and Amazon or some combination. And those companies increasingly are mining and refining health data because they're increasingly offering their own health things, or they're starting to build their own health things.
My Samsung has a health app. It's monitoring everything because I can.
Here's the concern that I have. The concern that I have is that all this technology that we've been talking about today, 10 years from now, or perhaps, you know, maybe 5 years from now, makes a decision that I haven't burned enough calories and somebody's decided to optimize and nudge me into better health, and therefore I can't open my garage door and drive to work. I have to take my bike or walk.
But you would do that because you get a 30% discount in your insurance.
Wait a minute. This is kind of a serious point, is because the problem is that decision-making technologies are by design inflexible, and there's always context. So sure, there are days that I'm feeling like lazy and I don't want to move and I don't want to exercise and I just want to eat whatever and be left alone. You know, there are other days when there may be very real reasons that I cannot, like right now I've got two broken ankles, right? And
Did you jump out of an airplane without a parachute?
No, it's a long story.
Oh dear, I'm sorry.
No, I fell off of a stage.
Oh
God!
But then, like David Grohl, I picked up my guitar and I kept rocking.
He said, "I'm okay."
Kind of, and then I have to go in for surgery in a couple weeks. But my point is, like, my foot hurts, you know, and I technically can walk, but it hurts really badly to walk right now.
So you shouldn't.
And the thing is that our smart devices
doesn't know
again.
That.
Like, you have to start thinking this through. It's not just about insurers cost you charging less money or more money.
We'll make it possible for you to call and ask for a waiver today.
But think of
your number 43. Is important to us.
my concern is that there's relatively like a few number of people who are making these decisions about what our best lives and our most optimized lives are, who don't have as wide a cultural perspective as I might like, who can't possibly think through every possible variable, and we don't have overwrite capacity. So, and terms of service are changing all the time, and if you don't have like an eagle eye paying attention to all of this, you miss it. And my concern is always for everyday people who are caught in the middle of all of this stuff, whose lives wind up unintentionally worse off because there wasn't transparency or nobody thought that, you know, explaining things was all that important, or that they were just going to force them to live their best life, their best, healthiest life. And therefore we were going to use their data in this way. There's always external circumstances that we got to take into account.
I 1000% agree. I mean, and you're right. And we don't do a good enough job with the way that we train these models. And there isn't really the push to train them better, where, like you said, we look at those nuances and where people think about what the potential consequences are. And even if, you know, my personal circumstances right now wouldn't be negatively impacted, doesn't mean that they couldn't be down the line, or that I even want it to be part of consideration at all, you know, because a lot of times the data doesn't even show what people want to read from it. You know, I mean, I think you're exactly right. These things can have long-term negative impacts on our society that we don't take into account, and that doesn't have enough scrutiny, because people are thinking, oh, look at how great this is, and look at how much this will be optimized and how much more productive we'll be. But
more importantly, I think it's clear that insurance companies need to be more profitable.
Somebody actually just in the IRC wrote, KV just wrote, it's a privacy tax on the poor. And I think that's a really smart.
Oh, completely.
That's an
that's completely accurate.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But I think it's a privacy tax on the poor and those
Why?
Who
Explain
either.
Explain that.
Pardon?
Explain how it's a privacy tax.
Yeah. So I don't think it is at the moment, but I think it will be increasingly. If you've got all of these devices, and so the way that I like to think about this is, you know, Apple charges a premium. But Apple's devices are the privacy is fairly shored up and people understand what data probably is moving around and where. But that's not the case with all of these other devices. And if you're somebody who wants to be connected but can't afford to buy into Apple's ecosystem, then your data are more likely to be extracted and mined and refined and given away. So but it's not like entirely transparent that that's what's happening, right? And the health device. So if you're somebody who can't afford to pay or you need to pay less for your insurance for whatever reason, and you're willing to give up your data, I mean, it's kind of like a privacy tax.
In other words, you have worse insurance. It'll pay more for insurance if you can't afford to have the fancy monitoring stuff.
Or you're trying to just pay less for whatever reason.
Exactly.
And you don't understand what you're giving up in the process, right?
Right. Well, and it's not just the poor. I would also say the elderly, because like my parents are both of the age where I guess they're on Medicare or whatever. And that's what's offering, I guess my dad gets his free Fitbit thingy or whatever, you know, and obviously once you're at retirement age and whatnot, you know, and you're living off of your retirement, off of your savings, off of whatever stipends you're getting, that's going to go into consideration too. So I think it's the poor and the elderly, and we're all going to be older at one point, regardless of what we do. So, yeah.
Well, how about this?
There is an optimistic framing here, though.
How about this? Go ahead. A new policy proposal by the Trump administration calls for the surveillance of disabled people's social media profiles to determine the necessity of their disability benefits. The proposal, which aims to cut down on the number of fraudulent disability claims, would monitor the profiles of disabled people and flag content that shows them doing physical activities.
That's horrific.
How about this? Here's a patent application from State Farm for, they call it the aggregation and correlation of data for life management purposes. It's a plan for aggregating home data, vehicle data, and personal health data to help you have a better life. Of course, State Farm's interest is not in having you have a better life.
No, it's not. I was hit by a car a year and a half ago. So I'm dealing with insurance stuff right now because I was some idiot drove his car into me when I was crossing the street in a pedestrian crosswalk, and I
this is separate from the bus incident?
This was the bus
incident. Oh, okay.
So I was hit by the car, thrown under the bus. And so I'm dealing with insurance right now with his insurance company, and it's a whole thing. And my God, and already it's dealing with, they're trying to kind of be like, oh, it wasn't that bad. You went to work the next day. And I was like, well, yeah, because I'm dumb. And because I didn't, you know, like,
oh, yeah.
I
was so there you go. They got you.
Not. I'm like, I still couldn't write. I couldn't use, I'm right-handed. I couldn't type. I couldn't use my wrist for you know, like sufficiently. Like I've got all kinds of evidence and everything. But
there was a Jack Lemmon movie years ago called The Fortune Cookie. Jack Lemmon's an insurance examiner following a guy around on crutches to find out if he really is hurt. Here's the, by the way, this is a brilliant patent application. Here's you, Christina.
Yeah.
Here's your car. Here's your house. It all goes into the cloud,
the brain,
where a computing device, which includes a processor, memory, and user interfaces, processes it, puts it back down in the data processor so that we can, I don't
judge.
Know, manage your life. Yeah, judge. So that we can judge. I need a picture of the judging.
So I'm going to say this once again. Everybody loves to point the finger at China and China's social credit system.
Yes.
And, you know, wow, that's crazy. Thank God we don't live there. And you know, ours is just not that coordinated.
Right.
But you're crazy to think that. And the thing that really gets me, is that it's happening in slow motion right in front of our eyes.
Yeah.
And we marvel at it and we fetishize the future and we don't take any action.
Right.
And again, like, this is where things get sticky because we have to be able to mine and refine and automate some of these processes in order to do things like use machines to help us figure out cures to cancer, like to do all of these amazingly difficult, wicked, you know, problem solving that we want to accomplish, that's possible, that's on the horizon. We got to figure out a way to do this without our consumerism getting in the way and our, you know, strong desire to make a buck every, you know.
Well, thank
you.
Like,
this is complicated because these companies are public and they have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders. We got to sort this stuff out.
I'm just grateful that Google has decided to create an AI ethics board to manage this.
It's going so well.
Oh, wait a minute.
So well.
They canceled it. One week later.
That was...
Never mind. It was only going to meet four times a year anyway, so...
Doomed from the start.
Yeah.
Completely.
Was the strangest assemblage of people that I've... I mean, like, that was a weird... That was weird from the beginning.
Yeah. Let's take a break, and we'll be back with more. First, before we do anything, we should... I wasn't here last week, and I've asked... we put cameras everywhere in the building, and I've asked our team to put together a surveillance video of what I missed this week on Twit. Let's watch together.
On Twit.
This was part of my pirate costume that I wore for Halloween, I think a couple years ago.
Right, your Johnny Depp costume?
That's what everybody said, but I was like, no, I'm just a standard pirate because Johnny Depp.
Yeah.
No, not him.
Yeah, okay, sorry.
All about Android.
Look at this gaming laptop of a phone.
That is a gamer phone.
Now, why are there connectors on the sides of this case?
Interesting.
Because intellectual property be damned.
Yeah, clearly.
Cool. The Black Shark 2 is the device that's really interesting.
Tech News Weekly.
According to a new Gallup poll, 61% of people polled believe that they use their phone less than the people around them. That's 61% of people believe that they use their phone less.
In reality, in my case, it's true. Am I part of the problem?
I wouldn't consider you part of the problem, but I think you're lying to yourself, probably.
You know what you do?
What?
We share an office and you talk to your Google Assistant a lot, and I think you're talking to me. And there needs to be a word. Like, you're just like, remind me to get the laundry. I was like, I'm not going to remind you to get the laundry.
Twit. Technology isn't always pretty, but we are.
Aw. Jason Howell.
How is that phone not getting, how are they not getting sued by Nintendo?
Oh, yeah, because it's exactly the same as the Nintendo Switch. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it looks pretty
Nintendo's
cool.
Nintendo's getting sued by GameShark over.
Really?
Yes.
For real?
For real, yeah.
That's the Shark 2. Oh, so GameShark did it first.
Yes.
Then Nintendo did it. Then GameShark.
The people suing Nintendo.
That's nuts. I didn't know that.
See? It's something called there's a phrase for it, reverse confusion. When a company comes along, I don't know, let's say you had a podcast network called Twit, and a company comes along and names itself similarly and then becomes really big and successful, then people just assume that you, little Twit, copied the big successful company. When in fact it was GameShark that had the idea all along. Our show today. You like my beads? Our show today brought to you. I got this at a luau, and I got this when we checked in. Our show today brought to you by ExpressVPN. You better believe when I'm on the road, if I am on an app and Wi-Fi access point, you know, we get to the hotel and they say, oh, hey, good news. Just go ahead and use the Wi-Fi. There's no password. There's no anything. Just go ahead and use it. That's crazy. That means I'm on the same network as everybody else at that hotel and anybody who's sitting anywhere nearby because everybody can use it. That's when you fire up the VPN. And you better believe I fired up ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN is a virtual private network that will protect you on public Wi-Fi. If you leave that internet connection unencrypted, you might as well be writing your password and your credit card numbers on a billboard for the rest of the world to see. ExpressVPN protects you by encrypting all the traffic from right through that hotel's Wi-Fi, all the way from your computer to the ExpressVPN servers. And by the way, servers all over the world,
160 different locations. So you could choose a server near you, or you could choose a server that's in the country you want to emerge in. If you're in, you know, a foreign land and you want to use your Netflix, no problem. Just, you know, use the ExpressVPN server in the U.S. and you're there. You're secured. You're anonymized. Your data is encrypted. And very important, when you're looking for a VPN, ExpressVPN does no logging. They are not tracking you. So if you're worried that you're being tracked by your ISP or your carrier, if you're worried that you're being snooped upon, if you're worried that you're being attacked, get ExpressVPN. They have simple apps that run on any iPhone, Android phone, Mac, or PC. One button click and you're protected and safe. And it's less than $7 a month for the number one VPN service, according to TechRadar, and a 30-day money-back guarantee. So protect your online activity today. Find out how you can get 3 extra months free with a 1-year package at expressvpn.com/twit. Express, E-X-P-R-E-S-S, expressvpn.com/twit. Don't ask me how to spell VPN. expressvpn.com/twit. 3 extra months with a 1-year subscription. We thank them for their support. We thank you for supporting them and thereby supporting us. YouTube struggling a little bit because there's a lot of video on there that advertisers don't want to buy. And they're getting a lot of heat for a lot of weird things. So according to Bloomberg, they're now trying a new metric Bloomberg calls responsibility. Two new internal metrics at YouTube introduced over the last 2 years to figure out how well videos are performing. Not how many subscribers, not how many views. One tracks the total time people spend on YouTube, including comments they post and read, not just clips. The other is a measurement called quality watch time. The goal is, anyway, to spot content that achieves something more constructive than just keeping you watching. Is this a sensible plan from YouTube's point of view? One of the problems people have with YouTube is the recommendation engine that slowly pushes you towards more and more extreme content in order to increase your watch time. This sounds like this is Google's attempt to get around that. Thoughts? Christina?
I mean, it's not a bad option to go to, I guess.
Did you ever consider being a YouTube star, Christina?
If I were 10 years younger, totally.
What does that have to do with it?
I think I'm too old. But
How old do you have to be? You're a kid. What do you have to be, 12?
I think you definitely need to be like in your early 20s. Yeah, like I think you need to be in your early 20s. Like, but you know, if I were 10 years younger, I think that would have been the direction I would have gone in.
Explains why I can just never get my YouTube numbers up.
We have a family friend that's grooming. It's not my family. It's my husband's family knows people who are grooming their 11 or 12 year old to become influencer. And it's like,
it's like grooming your kid to be horrifically disappointed in life.
For real.
But there's something analogous to what YouTube is currently doing and what the broadcast industry did, I think, just after TV started broadcasting, which was, and again, I think this has to do with potential impending regulation. It's proving that there's some type of beneficial component to the content that's being aired. So the original when kids programming was first on, the industry went through that decades and decades ago.
It strikes me as the same thing, though, that every tech company, Facebook's doing this too now, where they throw out ideas that they have no intention of, you know, they're not going to change anything, but they're so terrified that Congress is going to come down on them. It's basically hand waving, if you ask me.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, listen, every time. So how are they going to, what's the work stream process? Like, I'd love to know exactly how this is going to work.
Yeah, that's very vague. What is quality time? What does that even mean? Right. How do you judge that?
And who's defining it?
The problem really is, it's the same problem Facebook faces, which is if you, and it's algorithmically easy to do, you optimize for engagement. That's something a computer program can easily do. Optimize for engagement. Mm-hmm. You get, and Facebook experienced this in the news feed, and YouTube's experiencing it in the recommendation engine, and it just descends to the lowest I guess TV went through this too, didn't it? Lowest possible quality stuff.
Right. When I think of, so again, like when I see, first of all, my daughter doesn't, we built
how old
her
is
her
she?
Own
how
network.
Old is she?
She's eight. And as far as she's concerned,
so she's prime whole, YouTube material.
Right. Except that we built her own network. So she thinks she has free and unfettered access to the internet. And we built her like a little Chinese internet inside of our house.
That's amazing.
So she
baby's first Chinese internet. I like it.
Yeah. No, she thinks she's balling. Like, you know, she's got it, got all access and, so, you know, surprise.
How do you do this? Because clearly like things like parents thought, oh, YouTube kids, that'll be safe. And then they found out YouTube it's creepy as hell.
No, it's not. A lot of the content, my first window into what this world was like were unboxing videos. And I could not for the life of me figure out why, because I watched, that's what she wanted to watch a couple of years ago. And I was just like, what? I don't understand this. And then I don't know if it was in the New Yorkers. There was a doctor who had written an explanation of why these unboxing videos were so attractive to little kids. And it's because at very early ages, their sensory systems and emotional maturity are just starting to tap into the element of surprise and delight.
Right.
But without the negative repercussions. It's like stimulating the part of the brain that's just starting to develop. And that stupid, what's the name of that stupid doll thing? They come in these
which
big
which one? There's
big
quite
spheres.
A few of them. Yeah.
The Kinder Eggs? No, they're not Kinder
but
Eggs.
But there's these are like all these spheres. YouTube unwrapping videos of these stupid
things. Yep. These toys were reverse engineered.
Yes.
They were a toy version of an unboxing video.
Yes.
There's like 100 different things to
the Hatchimals?
You know, unbox. Hatchimals? No, it's not a Hatchimal. What the hell are these stupid things?
That's
called?
A horrible name, whatever that is.
At any rate,
they're hatchable. They're Hatchimal they're hatchable. Collectible.
Believe it or not, Hatchimals are something else that are all equally.
So the Great Firewall of Amy. How does this protect her against Hatchimals?
Okay, so originally we were like kids. You know, YouTube kids. I guess I was drinking the Kool-Aid along with everybody else.
Yeah.
How horrible would this be?
It's safe.
And then I realized, you know, some of it is like this kind of programming, which is stimulating in a way. There's also, there's plenty of fine.
Are you ready for a super?
Sorry, I don't know why my volume is so high. I'm watching a little Hatchimals.
Yeah, it's not. That's actually not it. This is something worse.
Even worse?
Yeah.
It's the Hatchimals unboxing.
LOL surprise dolls.
What is it?
What it is.
What are they called?
LOL surprise dolls. They are expensive. They are horrible. But that is what was reverse engineered. They're brilliant. That's what got reverse engineered.
Oh, I'm looking at these. Oh,
yeah, both Christy and I are quickly Googling LOL surprise dolls. I gotta have.
So I let her watch YouTube at the beginning, and then I saw what it was. And not all of it's bad. Some of it's bad. Some of it, I think, must have been what me watching Bill Nye the Science Guy was probably like to my parents.
Well, that's the problem. Remember, how do you judge, right?
That's the point. Like Bill Nye the Science Guy was obviously that was educational. That was amazing. But for somebody who was older, it was a lot of jarring quick cuts and loud music and big graphics, which I'm sure a lot of people railed against and older people and thought, well, this is horrible. Much like today, we are railing against some of what we're now seeing on YouTube was the point that I was trying to get to 20 minutes ago. Anyhow, we don't use.
Yeah, I guess in if not Bill Nye, I mean, because that's actually educational. This would be more like Jim and the various other cartoons like G.I. Joe, the things that they created, like the animated show Jim, like it was literally created to sell a toy brand, right? Like they created these Saturday morning cartoons with the express purpose of selling toys. So they did the same type of thing where they're like, okay, we're going to create this TV show that its whole purpose is to launch a toy line. Which
I don't know if LOL. I mean, LOL Surprise Dolls is kind of cool, although it's clearly it even says on the doll, unbox me. So
the whole point of it is, right, so if you watch any more of it, it is an unboxing video that is just made out of plastic. So the problem that I have with these is that once, it is an activity. So once, it's, so.
And it does it encourage kids to create their own YouTube channel? I mean, is that, it's,
No, my daughter doesn't want to do that. But once you've unwrapped, there is no toy. So that the thing that you do was unbox it. You unwrap it in all these different places. And then you're not going to, they're little tiny, you're not going to play with them. So all we're doing is generating a lot of waste that winds up getting thrown out.
It's a ball full of plastic crap that you're going to throw out later.
That's right. And they're selling an activity, right? And these, by the way, are really expensive. But this is somebody who reverse engineered a commercially viable internet meme, nice which are sunglasses. Unboxing videos, and has done quite well.
There's the gauntlets or the boots or something. Yeah.
These are like these little balls that you're seeing get unwrapped. Those things are like $50.
$50.
Some of them, the larger that they are, the more expensive.
The bigger
these
balls cost more.
Expensive.
Yeah. Okay, but you get a doll. See, and then it dresses up
for $50. That's
okay.
No.
So this is not clearly Bill Nye the Science Guy.
No, but my point was like this.
But
is
we can't judge. We're a different generation.
I think so,
and the problem is your daughter in 15 years is not going to be able to talk to her peers about LOL surprise me dolls.
There is plenty of I think content on YouTube created by younger kids that is probably. Educational, nowhere near what Bill Nye was like. They're not even.
There is good science video on YouTube that kids watch.
It's not a fair comparison.
Yeah.
Right. So the question is, isn't there value in watching a cartoon that is about like the reboot of She-Ra is amazing. Now that's not on YouTube. That was on Netflix. But it's like.
So do you have? So I still want to know about the Great Firewall of Amy. So do you have a white list of things she can look at, or how does this work? Do you have a Plex server where you stock it?
We also have that
family approved videos.
So we have. How much do I invite the outside world into?
Well, just the general gist, so somebody can duplicate.
Yeah, the gist is we have multiple networks that serve different purposes that are all behind different types of firewalls themselves.
You are such a geek.
Her network, the joke in our family is that my husband is hardware and I'm software, except when it's a whole other thing.
Have VLANs in your house?
Yes.
We
bought a 100-year-old house and the first thing we did was run conduit everywhere so that we could run our own cables.
Yep. Do you have a closet, like a wiring?
We have a beautiful rack in the basement. It's gorgeous.
Amazing.
It's very sunny. And
the Great Firewall of Amy has a beautiful rack in the basement.
No, I'm very intrigued by this because
the title's getting longer and longer and longer.
No, like I'm not a parent and I'm not going to be one, but this seems like this is the right way if you're going to do it to do it. Because I always thought to myself,
brilliant.
I'm like,
but there is a risk. No, I have to point out there is a risk because the worldview is created by mom and dad and it is a limited worldview. Now, I understand she's young enough, that's probably okay, and it's normal. But I also know kids who grew up and the only thing they could watch was, Bible verse cartoons.
Yeah, yeah. No. It's not like that. It's more, we want to give her, we've basically turned the internet off except for white labeled places where she can go.
I think that's great, honestly.
There is no YouTube kids.
At what age will you stop this, though?
I don't know. As she matures, you know, she's eight. She's an only child. She's a fairly, we're old parents. She's a fairly mature 8-year-old, but we'll see.
This reminds me a lot of what Stacey Higginbotham does with her daughter, by the way.
Yeah. And so Stacey and I know each other. I mean, I think that there are parents who are sort of, I don't believe in no screen time. I believe in smart screen time.
Cultivated screen time.
That's right. Curated. So she has access to all of the robots and all of the device. We've got a house full of stuff that she can access, but she's only accessing it on her network.
Do you teach her? Are you teaching her coding?
No, they do some of that at school, but I'll tell you what they do at school that's amazing. They have digital literacy classes where once a week they have to learn, Bobby put a photo without asking Jane. And
That's really good.
It's part of their values class is digital values, which is amazing. But, not every school does that.
No, but see what I like about this, because see, my whole thing, most parents that I've talked to who try to do similar things, they don't go to the extreme you have. But this is smart because I always think about, like, what if it were me at that age? And if it were me at that age, I would figure out the mom and dad were censoring the internet, and I would find out how to, like, override the system. But this is pretty...
This would take...
Right. No, I know.
Yeah, we're not hiding it from her.
I'm not saying you are. What I'm saying, though, is that I would know, and then I would be like, okay, well, then what do I need to do to take control of the router?
Exactly.
And the whole thing. Which at that point, I would like to think that if I were a parent, and again, I'm not one and I'm not going to be one, but if I were, I would like to think that if my child did do that successfully, I'd be like, okay, you know what? Congratulations. You deserve this.
Yeah. You have to earn your way out of the tech prison.
Right.
Yeah.
But this is a level above and beyond like what the
most people can't do this. You know, What they do is they go out and buy the Disney Circle thing and they let Disney decide.
Exactly.
This is the point I've been trying to make all night. Easy to get over.
Yeah.
Right. So the problem is that my husband's best friend is a white hat. We run in very technical circles, and so we're all on Keybase sharing ideas, parenting, you know, like we're in a different kind of situation than most people. We all share. We've got a Plex server that everybody shares, and there is a like kid approved. Mm-hmm. If you're 7 years old, this is the stuff you get to watch. The problem is that I'm in a rarefied group of people, and I have all this additional knowledge. And my point is, like, I feel like everybody else should have access to at least the knowledge so that they can then make decisions, or they can afford. We can make it so that people can afford to buy in. Again, this goes back to the comment somebody made about privacy and taxes and wealth. If you don't know this stuff, or if you can't afford to make alternate choices or build out and provision like six different networks in your home, right? Because you can barely afford the one network that you've got access to in the standard modem and router situation, then you're kind of left. You're left open, and that impacts the future generation of people who grow up, you know.
This is interesting because this is the opposite of the privacy tax for poor people. There is a technologically savvy group of adults who are creating this safe space for a very small. You have to write a book, Amy. And I want you to call it the Great Firewall of Amy.
Thinking this could be productizized. Like, honestly, but this could be something.
The
that
problem
you would, like,
is productizes the
thing.
Problem because Disney Circle is going to have a corporate bias. I mean, I bet you anything, the new Disney streaming service will be part of the Disney Circle. You know,
that's
right?
I call Disney. I mean, like Synology or someone. You know what I mean?
Somebody.
Like, there's a way to do this if you were like a server company or like Amplify or somebody.
It seems to me this is the growing gulf between the haves and have-nots. Except it's the technically literate and the technically
right.
Illiterate.
And this is the problem that I have with all the people in the Valley who are now like the new autism, the new like I'm on the spectrum is my kids get no screens and they don't use any of the products that I work on.
Right.
And the problem that I have with that is that they're either being dumb or they're just trying to like. That doesn't make any sense. You know, like
you
can't live in a world that doesn't have technology. You're obviously tech savvy people. Why would you just sort of go in this weird alternate, but it doesn't, it's totally disingenuous or it's like
silly.
Intentionally being kind of dumb, you know?
Well, and I think a lot of it is the same because the same people who used to like when, you know, I was growing up and when you're growing up, your parents would be like, oh, well, my child doesn't watch TV. We don't have a TV in our house, which you know, it was just like, okay, good for you, I guess. But it seems
I can't even imagine Christina Warren not being able to watch TV.
What's so funny is that my parents like limited what I could watch to a certain age, you know, and then
me too. I got half an hour night.
And then I would get in trouble and I would negotiate with them and I would say, okay, so you put me on restriction, fine. Melrose Place is on and I can't miss Melrose Place, so I'll take 2 days if I can watch this Monday night at 8 o'clock.
I would gladly trade you Tuesday for a Melrose Place tonight.
Those are still good skills that you developed in the process.
Without negotiation.
I mean, I'll tell you, when I left, so the first time, I was basically gone. I missed the Clinton hearings. I missed like the mid-90s through the mid-2000s. I missed all that pop culture. And it was like an alien when I came back. And there's 10 years of my, you know, there's a big chunk of my life where I can't follow along a conversation once people, like I'm not part of that collective culture in my own country.
Is that a disadvantage?
I mean, it isn't. Yeah, I mean, it is in some ways. I miss some cues. I mean, obviously, I can follow along, but to me, this is why you don't. You can rage against the machine without cutting right. yourself off of the lifeblood that is the culture of
Completely.
The place you're living. Right.
That's good. I like it.
So again, it's like this, but we don't. Somehow, we've lost our ability to be flexible in how we think about stuff. It's either all or nothing. It's like. And there's plenty of parents that, you know, we go out to dinner and they plop their kids down with and I'm sorry if people listening to this are a family like this, but
almost everybody is. I should just
they plop their kids down with a screen, and that's how they do their dinner.
I never judge parents because it's such a hard job. And
yeah, no, and you shouldn't. And that's an excellent way to get trolled. So I'm not judging. I'm just stating. And there are parents who do completely the opposite, which is nobody gets any screen time ever.
I just give my kid a 5-pound bag of sugar-free gummy bears, and I said, kid, enjoy, and watch as much TV as you can, and I'll see you later. Our show today brought to you by WordPress. I'll tell you one thing, and I think this is true of your daughter, not yet, but there at some point, the other thing you have to decide with kids is their presence on the internet, because you can't keep a kid off or anybody off the internet, because that vacuum will be filled. It'll just be filled by other people's posts about your child, videos about your child, name calling, and all sorts of stuff. So I always tell teenagers, and I think it's right about 7th or 8th grade, get a website, start putting your best stuff on it. This is going to be you when people Google your name. So this is something you need to do. And it's true for individuals. It's true for businesses. You need to have a website. And that's why I always tell people about WordPress.com, because it's the easiest a free way to create your website right now that will become who you are. In fact, my suggestion is, you know, if you're having a kid, get their domain name now, register it. I did for my kids, got a 20-year domain name registered. I figured by then they'd know if they wanted it. Get their email account. Start this process right now. The minute Matt Mullenweg announced it, I started using it for my blog, and I've used it ever since. I've been on WordPress.com for 12 years because let them do the hard work. Let them do the hosting, the tech support. You know, you probably heard about some WordPress security flaws that somebody was just releasing into the wild this week without any warning. Hey, don't worry. WordPress.com takes care of that stuff, so you don't have to constantly follow all the security bulletins and make sure you're safe. You are safe. You're on WordPress.com. WordPress.com was started by Matt many years ago so that anyone could publish their ideas, have their voice on the web, put a portfolio up, open a store, start a blog, let people know about your business. And it's a site that's free to start but can grow with you, all the way up to an e-commerce site and some of the biggest publications in the world. They're using WordPress.com. No two-week trials, no hidden fees. And most importantly, you own your content forever. Sure, it's fine for your kid to have a Facebook page or an Instagram site or a Snapchat, whatever. But it's so important for you as an individual and for every business to have one place that's yours, that you own forever. Upload anything you want, text, pictures, video, audio, download it again and get it out. It's never trapped. And a great customer support team. They're not just page turners in a notebook. They're actually WordPress lovers and users and experts, and they're there 24 hours a day to help you, even weekends. The WordPress platform is powerful and flexible. It can grow as big as you need it to be, but it can start as small as you want. Millions of people use WordPress.com every day to turn their dreams into reality. In fact, the number that blows me away every time I read it, 33% of the entire internet is powered by WordPress. 1/3 of all the internet runs on the WordPress software. Best way to do it, WordPress.com. Go to WordPress.com/twit. You'll get 15% off any new plan purchase right now. WordPress.com/twit. 15% off any new plan purchase. WordPress.com/twit. Please go there so that they know you heard it here. That helps us, and we thank you, WordPress, for me personally, 12 years of LeoLaporte.com. I would imagine, given how sophisticated you are with your kid, Amy, that a website would be something you would do at some point too, right?
Do you agree with what I said about you've got to put yourself out there so that you control your reputation?
So I guess I'll just, we're all getting to know each other tonight. Why not, right? So we created a digital trust fund for her when she was born, which means that I registered her, you know, I've got her domain, I've got her social media names locked up and accounts, and I keep adding to it. But we don't post anything. So
yeah,
she's got it when she's ready. And then
the thing I wish I had thought of course, there was no Gmail at the time. My kids are 24 and 27, but I love this idea. Somebody told me about this years ago. Maybe it was, one of the geek dads. Get a Gmail account when your baby's born, start sending stuff to it, and then give her the keys to the account when she's, you know, 18 or 21, whatever you think is appropriate. I think that's I love that idea. That's the best baby book ever, right?
Yeah.
Technology could be, if you think about it, it could be used well. I wish you'd write a book or something. And
on parenting? Are you crazy? I would rather talk all day long about any other hot button issue you can imagine.
It's the hardest thing in the world, isn't it?
Parenting is the easiest way to invite lots of trouble into your life.
You know another way? Talk about politics. But I'm going to have to do it. The House has voted to save net neutrality. And the White House is, of course, going to veto it.
I feel like I have whiplash.
Yeah, this goes back and forth. Except it really doesn't go back and forth. It's really they eliminated it. And now they're just fighting and fighting and fighting. To get it back.
Meanwhile, the states are going ahead and passing their own resolutions.
Right.
And
so the issue, and of course, you know, that's problematic too, because the internet is a global phenomenon. It's absolutely
no. You're not wrong. I'm just saying. I'm glad I live in the state of Washington.
Yes,
so at the very least,
you have the best. You have the best law of all, right?
Right. So at least until this is all figured out, I don't have to worry about my ISP being given information, regardless of what the federal statutes are. So
you're going to hear from the White House when they veto it, because they will, the Save the Internet Act. You're going to hear stats that are essentially bogus. Since the new rule was adopted in 2018, consumers have benefited from a greater than 35% increase in average fixed broadband download speeds. And we went from 13th to 6th in the world. By the way, even that's nothing to celebrate. In 2018, fiber was also made available in more new homes than any previous year. Capital investment by the nation's top six internet service providers increased $2.3 billion. Some of this, of course, has been ongoing for years. Anyway, there's a good Verge article that debunks a lot of these claims, and it'd probably be worth reading it. And let's not give up the fight for net neutrality, because we know that that's something that has to happen. 23 state attorneys general are have filed lawsuits, and state by state, of course, including Washington state, states are enacting their own net neutrality.
So that's awesome.
Yes.
That means we're going to wind up with one of the tech trends we talked about and modeled a couple years ago was splinter nets, which is not a term that I made up. But I mean, it's just, again, like this is so stupid. Like with the last thing you want now is to have a state by like to, is to like have the states figure out how to handle
absolutely.
This. How do you like what does that do for business? It's just
when internet
stupid
data crosses state lines. What happens to it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and it's happening on international levels too, right? Like with some of the different proposals countries are coming up with.
Like, I lived in Philly for a while. Is this going to be a thing where you like sneak
I'm on the Philly internet. Hey.
You know, basically,
the Philly internet's the best internet.
Over to like Texas to get slightly better. Like you're going to change your IP so that you're like 10 miles away.
Now we have a good use for VPNs.
No, well, seriously.
50 servers, one for each state. You choose the internet you want.
How does that not wind up happening?
No, that's totally what's going to wind up happening, unless we can have an administration change and then roll back, this stuff, and then the FCC can do what it should be doing, which is to, protect people and not just hand everything over to the ISPs.
Although, as a classic example of what could possibly go wrong, the French Internet Referral Unit has reported to archive.org 550 of their archived URLs as terrorist contents, falsely, I might add.
Takedown notices from the French IRU for a bunch, including, by the way, the Gutenberg, Smithsonian, the Grateful Dead. Actually, the Grateful Dead might be considered terrorists to certain government agencies. I don't know. Crazy.
What is possibly, what was in that C-SPAN report? Like, what was, who was holding up what post, what floor chart that was deemed?
The problem is awesome. With the EU's laws, you get less than 24 hours to respond. The archive.org is panicking.
That's totally not the way that they intended.
No, there's a 1 hour. I'm sorry. Did I get it? I exaggerated. There's a 1 hour requirement. You have to take those URL down immediately. You have 1 hour to do so.
Or it, what?
Or
somebody comes and yells at you.
Somebody comes and hits you with a baguette. I don't know. I don't know. I'll take that baguette. The French Internet Referral Unit falsely identified hundreds of URLs on archive.org as terrorist propaganda. The 1 hour requirement means, by the way, there was no one there when they came in. It was on the weekend. It's a mistake. Blocking procedures may be implemented against us, says archive.org, if we don't remove the content. So they'll be blocked in France. Splinternet. That's the in the
we do not want our we do not want a the balkanization of our tech and our digital right. infrastructure. This gives extraordinary power to authoritarian regimes who would love to see us fighting these stupid, dumb. I mean, just these. This is just a again. This is like. This is why regulation often doesn't work. I mean, I understand why people, why we pursue it, but in practice, it doesn't work. And
but you've been arguing for it all along.
No, I've not been arguing for regulation. I'm very much. I think the blunt instrument of regulation is the not the smart way forward. The smart way forward is to come up with something we don't have yet, which I know is much more difficult. But we've got to figure out a way to collaborate. Where again, you know, we have three like epicenters of power. At least in this country, Wall Street, DC, and our West Coast capital, which is the Valley / Bellevue, you know, and we got to figure out a way to get them to collaborate.
Oh my God, we're screwed.
Well, I'm just saying, like, otherwise,
it's not going to happen.
No, but regulation is bad. And this is another one of these things where, like, this kind of regulation, because it doesn't make sense. I mean, look, you just read it to us.
No, it's crazy.
It's crazy.
It's crazy.
And France doing its own thing. And all of these different companies now and countries coming up with their own policies and value statements around all different types of technology, including AI. There's an evangelical group of Christians who have now come up with a Christian stance on what AI should be.
Oh, God.
So I what the val what like the, this is my point. Like, we're all going about this. We're all doing our own thing and what happens when everybody's individual interests wind up colliding, which they're going to, you know, then you wind up with a takedown notice for floor charts shown on C-SPAN. It makes no sense.
I really, there's so many great stories, but we've gone way too long, so we're going to have to wrap it up. I really did want to talk about the Secret Service agent when they arrested that Chinese woman who had four phones.
She's the malware.
A malware and a USB stick about the Secret Service agent who plugged it into a machine to see what was on it. But we'll just save that for another day.
Was that a male or a female agent?
Does it matter?
Yes, it does. Because I bet you that person has a lot of sex without condoms.
Samuel Ivanovich. Who was the first person to interview Jiang at Mar-a-Lago, testified that, he didn't. So he didn't do it. Another agent put Jiang's thumb drive into his computer and immediately began to install files. A very out of the ordinary event he had never seen happen before.
What are you doing?
Oh, my God. This is from the Miami Herald. Oh, my God. Well, maybe we don't. What we don't know, maybe it was a very special personal computer that wasn't connected to the internet or something.
I mean, we can hope, but like, I meet some, I arrest somebody for suspicion on something, I'm totally just going to take their thumb drive and plug it into my computer. Like, mm-hmm. yeah, of course. That's the very first thing I'm going to do.
immediately began to install files, a quote, very out of the ordinary event he had never seen happen before during this kind of analysis. Analysis?
Oh my God.
What is it? The analysis? Let's open it and see what happens. The agent had to immediately stop the analysis to halt any further corruption of his computer. The analysis is still ongoing, but inconclusive.
I don't think they know what analysis means.
I think it's your brother-in-law.
No, I was going to say.
Your dad.
All right. It's totally my dad.
Well, let's see what's on it. Let's see what happens. You know, you can turn off auto run. I'm just saying.
Exactly.
That EXE, what does that mean? Excellent. I should click on it.
All right. Enough. I am so happy to have you two on here. We decide normally we have a 4-person panel. We said, no. Christina Warren, Amy Webb, that's all we need. That's a show. And I absolutely proved true. Christina is the greatest. We've known her since the good old days of Mashable, senior developer advocate, cloud developer advocate at Microsoft now. Catch her at the Ignite Tour coming soon to a town near you.
Yes.
And on Channel 9, you do stuff there too, right?
I sure do. YouTube.com/Microsoft Developer.
Nice.
So you are on YouTube. You are a YouTube
She's
star.
She's a YouTube star. Oh,
I'm a YouTube star for you know.
Geeks.
Nerds.
The best, yes. The best audience.
Without a doubt.
You are an influencer.
She's an influencer. Of course she is. And always glad to have you. Thank you for keeping the lights on late at night in Redmond.
Thank you for having me.
Are you rushing off to watch Game of Thrones? We have how many hours?
Yes. Happy Game of Thrones Eve.
We have an hour.
Now, they put it out on, if you have HBO Go, you can watch it early, right?
That's what I'm doing, exactly.
So it's, East Coast. So in 1 hour, and you could watch it right now, Amy.
Yeah, I'm. In fact, if I don't leave pretty soon, I'm gonna get.
Are you having a party?
Yelled at.
Is your party of two? Is your eight? You don't let your 8-year old watch Game of Thrones. It's not on the. It's blocked
That's
by the great
provision.
Firewall of Amy. You know, provision.
No, not provisions.
No, I don't blame you. All right, Amy Webb, the author of The Big Nine. You got to read this great book, and always welcome on our air. You can find out more at the Future Today Institute, or just go to amyweb.io. And I'm glad to know you're on Keybase. I did not know that. I will figure out your handle and follow you.
Good luck.
I searched for Amy Webb. I didn't find it. You could follow me. I'm Leo Laporte. Keybase.
I will.
Everybody who's a geek should know about keybase.io. It's free and it's an amazing service. I use their encrypted Git for all my private stuff. It's fantastic and great.
Yeah, it's
encrypted
awesome.
Chat keeps it your PGP's keys and all that stuff. Thank you, Amy. Thank you, Christina.
Thanks.
What a great show
Thank
to come
so
back
much.
To. This is actually better than Kauai.
No,
you're
it's
lying.
Not.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that.
It's better
you're
than
lying.
The luau we saw last night. I'll say that.
That
How
may
about
be
that?
True. That may be true.
Thank you, everybody. We do Twit every Sunday afternoon around about 2:15, right after the radio show. That's 2:15 Pacific, 5:15 Eastern time. That's about, 21:20 UTC, something like that. Come by, watch twit.tv/live. There's a live audio and video stream, so you can watch or listen. If you're doing that, Chatroom is a great place to hang out. They're watching and listening live, too. It's irc.twit.tv. Everybody, even Amy's daughter, will feel safe there. It should be inside the great firewall of Amy. If you want to watch us in studio, you're more than welcome to do so. We had a great live audience from all over the world, from Australia and Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Washington, D.C., and Mountain View. Please come and join us. Just email tickets at twit.tv. We'll put a chair out for you. You can also get on-demand versions of everything we do at our website, twit.tv, or best idea yet, subscribe in your favorite podcast application. That way you won't miss an episode. You'll have it in time for your Monday commute. Enjoy Game of Thrones, everybody. We'll see
Woo-hoo.
You next time.
Thank you.
Another Twit
this
is in the can. Bum, 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 bum. Doing the Twit.